You know, magic word. The words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words of the signs of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all. You know, you've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation. And, of course, it does cost you a huge amount of money.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday the 23rd of September 2022, live from, well, actually we are at the PRSC Arts Centre, but we're also remote in Bristol and in London. And we're all on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. And also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is now available from the Apple App Store, amazingly. I don't know how someone's managed to allow that, but anyway, if you've got an iPhone or one of the other Apple-y type things, you can go on there and download our app, amazingly, which will remind you when the show is about to go out, so it'll just give you a little ping. And also, you can listen to the live stream, but you can easily download all of the clips, because, you know, as you know, if you hear anybody that we've got clips with, that I've done a longer interview with, or that we've got a longer version, if you find that interesting, you can go and download the whole thing and listen to it all. So, for example, we've got Piers Corbyn on tonight, a couple of clips with him talking about the solar system and various other things. But if you want to hear the long one, there it is on the app, easily downloadable. I mean, obviously, you can do that all on the website or probably on your phone too. Not necessarily Google, so you don't have to use Google. And we've got, if you go to the show page at thisweek.org.uk, you'll find a non-Google app store where you can download the BCFM Politics Show app. So, we have arrived on Apple. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade, zero carbon, zero COVID. Well, actually, thankfully, not anymore. And the Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, as well as promoting that medical misinformation. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix this week, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and maybe even into a Third World War. I don't know if Martin's going to do the navigating into that, but we'll see. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In part one this week, we start off by looking at the mass trespass and then straight on to land and the Queen's funeral. What was the Queen's funeral really all about? Quite a momentous event on Monday, and many tens of thousands of people turned out to see the coffin and the motorcade as it went from, followed by a coach load of international leaders down the A4 and the A30 to Windsor. And also, Enough is Enough comes to Bristol on Tuesday in the evening. We had a rally with between 500 and 600 people in Bristol, where they're talking about, well, we've just had enough of all this nonsense. And of course, he's quite right. We hear from Barry West tonight, who was the speaker, a Southwest regional organiser for the Rail Maritime Transport Union. Also, we've seen riots in Leicester this week. We'll be chatting about that. As well as, well, just the response by this government to the so-called cost of living crisis. Well, it's like almost like the engineered masochistic attack on the British people by the Tory government, you know, the sort of thing that we've seen for decades, actually, but really ramping it up with Kwasi Kwarteng as budget, mini budget today. A little bit of a look also at vaccine injury. Nothing to see here. A clip from the Mark Steyn show, the excellent, brilliant. I sometimes look at Mark Steyn and I think, well, I may as well retire. He's doing a superb job. And also, as I mentioned, Piers Corbyn talking about the moon and also about the latest and Ukraine, etc. In part two, we'll start off by looking at the riots in Iran. And then skip over to Moscow, to Putin's announcement about the mobilisation of 300,000 reservists over there for the Ukraine fight. And then, obviously, we're going to be looking at the United Nations General Assembly, particularly the responses from Israel and Iran, and from our very own new Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly. And also Liz Truss gets to do her big speech at the UN. Not that impressive. She's kind of stumbling over her words quite a lot. And I think maybe... there's people who are wondering why on earth she was chosen by the powers that be to be the British ambassador, essentially. Well, she's prime minister, but ambassador to the UN. You know, that's what she's kind of being at the moment over there. Also, of course, she's escaped all the criticism here for the problems that she's causing and the idea of so-called tax breaks for the super rich. Well, that's exactly what we need, isn't it? Sergei Lavrov over at the UN too. So I did a piece earlier this week. I haven't seen really anybody else doing it, but I don't usually have clips of me speaking, but this is about a short clip about a potential nuclear false flag, because we've had all the talk this week of nuclear weapons in Ukraine, so-called saber rattling, and what about a nuclear false flag? That'd be an interesting but at least a little bit different to the chemical weapons false flags we keep seeing, and also a look at some documentaries. This is one thing I think, you know, I don't really do enough of. I'm holding my hands up here because there's quite a lot of good documentaries. I mean, we're always moaning about how rubbish the BBC and ITV, apart from when there's a John Pilger documentary on, there are some very good and interesting documentaries out there. Don't necessarily agree with everything that's in them, but you will find a tremendous amount of information in these internet documentaries on YouTube, or obviously nothing to do with the COVID will be found on YouTube because they just censor everything. But there's all sorts of stuff. So we're going to be looking at a couple of those tonight, along with, and winding up by, a look at genetic entropy with John Gideon Hartnett from Australia. And finally, a revisiting of the accelerationists. These are the people that want to start a third world war. Anyway, Martin, I hope you don't mind me starting with an item which I don't imagine you're going to be that excited about, which is this mass trespass. The idea really is to, take bits of land and places which people are excluded from. And we're now in a situation where even in an area of outstanding natural beauty, the centre parks can just come along, get planning permission to build a multi-million pound place there. Actually, what they're doing also is they've been excluding people from walking there themselves, but with the advantage of selling it off to a private developer who is now going to be building there. So it seems like quite the sort of place that, you know, it's important to draw attention to, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know why you presume I'm opposed to mass trespass, because I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, no, okay. So you're not that interested in this sort of thing normally, are you?
Well, no. I mean, land rights are important. They're fundamental, and that includes the right to roam, for example. And, of course, in Scotland, you do have the right to roam because it was passed by the Scottish Parliament. That's what campaigners south
that's
of the...
That's right. It's absolutely brilliant. But there's a double-edged sword in Scotland because the squatting laws are much, much tougher. So, you can walk around in the countryside to your heart's content, but as soon as you try and get a roof over your head, the police turn up and you're under arrest.
Well, squatting laws in the south of the border are pretty draconian now,
that's
aren't
true.
They?
They have got more...
They used to be, going back to... precedent, a right to squat in England, but it's been taken away by successive Conservative governments.
Well, there is still we need to be clear that there is still a right to squat, but it's not residential property. So you're finding a lot of squatters are doing things like maybe squatting a pub or squatting a shop or squatting an industrial estate, that sort of thing.
Yes. I mean, people are going to adapt to whatever the law is if they've got nowhere to live, aren't they? And there is still a big difference between the legal system in Scotland and England, because they're two separate countries which were joined in 1707, but they've not been fully joined ever since. You know, there was just a different way of doing things.
So anyway, this mass trespass, it starts from Balcombe Station, which is down near Crawley in Sussex. And it's, if you want to find out any more about it, I'm afraid it's just a website, really. Landscapesoffreedom.com. That's landscapesoffreedom.com. This does also, though, you see, this is one of the reasons I like to start with this, is because, look, you know, this is absolutely what the cost of living crisis is all about, the cost of housing. I was just looking, I think it's at the iNewspaper today. They're talking about, well, they're predicting that even not just the rented sector is, you know, I think it was in the Bristol Post this week. The rented sector here in the southwest is their prices are rising at the fastest rate on record. It comes down to supply and demand, one letting expert says. The cost of private home rental in the region of the southwest grew by the fastest rate ever in the 12 months up to June, Bristol Live can reveal. Prices were 4.1% higher in June of 2022 than 2021, largest year-on-year increase since records began in 2006. I mean, this is, yeah, the idea is that you're paying more and more and more. And actually, the fact is the landlords have got the whip hand now. They often don't even bother repairing their properties.
Well, that's true. And of course, it's because for over many decades, the whole thing has been rigged against those who have to rent privately. And, you know, many people who are buying their own houses with mortgages or with the bank of mum and dad actually pay far less for much better living conditions than people who in private rent it. And of course, there's going to be loads of evictions. And this is why people go to food banks. It's energy prices are important, but rent is a fundamental problem which has been crushing poorer people for a long time now.
Yeah, and if people manage to get up the property ladder a little bit and get a mortgage, well, I'm afraid there's horrific news for everyone who's done that. Millions, this is the front page of the Eye today, millions face mortgage hike as UK heads into recession. Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng under pressure to use a mini budget to prevent a deep recession after shock new warning that growth has gone into reverse. Bank of England have issued a downturn alert, and it's hiked interest rates to 2.25%, the highest since 2008. And experts warn the era of low rates is over. Millions then now face eye-watering mortgage increases up to £273 a month, with others facing increased threat of repossession as repayment costs soar. So people have got used to these low interest rates, a bit like we got used to the low cost of energy, Martin.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is that businesses will find borrowing more difficult as interest rates go up. And it's unusual for the Bank of England to increase interest rates when the economy is going into recession. But they've got to do that because of the circumstances we've found ourselves in as a result of all the stupid things we've done over previous decades.
And why have they got to? Why are they forced to?
Well, because the Bank of England has got a mandate, and it's, of course, separate from the government, to control inflation by raising interest rates. And that's their only mandate. So as inflation increases, partly to do with supply side inflation because of the increase in the cost of energy internationally and the price gouging by our own multinationals, which could easily be dealt with by having a windfall tax, but we're not going to do that, clearly. They've only got one club in their bag, and that is interest rate rises. Now, what's going to happen now is a battle between the Bank of England. As inflation rises, partly as a result of tax cuts for wealthy people and so on, the Bank of England will raise interest rates, we're going into recession. This is not going to be a recession. This is going to be a depression. A depression. It's going to last for a very long time. Lots of people are going to lose everything. And of course, there's going to be big upheaval on the back of all of that. But it's, you know, that's where we're going.
I think maybe it's a good time to listen to before she set off. Oh, I think actually, no, the BBC interviewed her about this domestic stuff over in New York. So let's just see how the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, is getting on being, you know, grilled by the BBC. Obviously, they don't say things. One of the things that I heard on the news during the week, but it's not in this interview, Martin, which was pretty shocking, was that she was asked by one journalist, said, oh, so can you guarantee that there won't be an economic crash while you're prime minister? And of course, she just dodged the question. Anyway, let's have a listen to her now talking about this increase in interest rates. This is Liz Truss here speaking earlier this week to, I think it's Chris Mason, is the new guy that's taken over from Koonsberg at the BBC.
Core part of your set of political priorities is economic growth, getting the economy growing. Are rising interest rates a price worth paying for that?
Well, interest rates are a matter for the Bank of England. You know, there's a reason why politicians don't set interest rates. We are responsible for economic policy, and what is absolutely crucial to our economic policy is getting economic growth going, because that's what we need to get more investment into the United Kingdom, to get more higher paid jobs, to get those opportunities for people right across the country, and we will be working to strain every sinew to make things happen, to get Britain moving and get that economic growth going that we need to make sure we have a secure future.
Sure, but if you jump on the economic accelerator, the Bank of England will be obliged to jump on the brake, and that will mean, will it not, that people are paying more for their mortgages?
I don't accept that analysis, and in fact, the energy package that we announced, and the business sector will be saying more about that this week, is projected to lead to a lowering of inflation by up to 5 percentage points, because a lot of the cost of inflation has been driven by higher energy prices, primarily caused by Putin's war in Ukraine. So the intervention the UK government is undertaking will help reduce inflation and also boost economic growth. So I don't accept that analysis. I think it's vital that we stepped in. There was a very real fear of businesses going under this winter, and many households would simply not have been able to afford those bills. So I think it's the right thing to do to step in to help in the short term, whilst we're making sure we're never in that position again, and that people and Britain has that long-term energy security.
So that's Liz Truss, the first of several clips from her. Martin, the main thing I want to know is, how on earth can upping interest rates actually accelerate growth? Because I would have thought that if people are having to suddenly pay loads more interest on the loans they've already got, then they may just go broke.
Well, that's because the policy is pulling in two different directions. As the BBC interviewer was suggesting, what they're trying to do is what was called a dash for growth in the early 70s when the Heath government did it. They've basically said, we're not bothered about balancing the books. We're going to give tax handouts to our solid supporters, the wealthy people. But it's not really a very good idea to give them the tax cut, because a lot of that stuff won't get spent. It'll just go into asset price increases. And of course, the Bank of England's job is to stop asset price inflation and all the rest of it. So they will raise interest rates. Patrick Minford, who's the only economist that's actually advised Liz Truss — most of the mainstream economists just think what she's talking about is rubbish — but he said we could have tax cuts for the wealthy, but interest rates will have to rise to 7%, because that's the price, and that will get rid of loads of zombie companies, and that's what's good for Britain. It'll also get rid of what's left of our industrial economy and get rid of our farmers. But of course, that's what you do if you're a radical free marketeer. You just think, well, we'll just get rid of existing stuff and we'll have all this new stuff, which will somehow come along. But of course, the problem for Liz Truss is that the economy is going in not into a recession, but into a depression. So this promise that she's going to get the economy going and grow the economy is what will happen is, even if she starts to push the economy in the right direction, the speculators will attack the pound, because they're not balancing the books according to what they think we should be doing. And at that point, the Bank of England has to raise interest rates, and then the economy collapses. So, it's bubble economics.
It almost seems to me,
steer the car carefully. It's attempting to put the accelerator on and hope you don't crash into the wall.
It almost seems to me that this is a set up recession or depression that's been created, and there's somebody somewhere from the City of London thought, we need to have a Prime Minister who will just say and do whatever we tell them to do through this phase. I mean, she's saying there that we don't control interest rates, but we do control economic policy. Well, surely interest rates are quite an important part of economic policy. What's she talking about?
Well, I mean, the neoliberal philosophy was that we're going to have interest rates outside the control of democratic governments, so that governments aren't tempted to spend when they haven't got any money. But of course, she's just ripped that up. Of course, we've had, a decade and more of Tory government where we've had all sorts of things like getting rid of 20,000 police officers, no wage increases, no more spending on the NHS. And she's just said, now we need to get a Tory government re-elected. All that stuff about saving money, that was all rubbish. We're against the orthodoxy. It's very interesting. If I was teaching economics now, you'd just point out how they've just completely contradicted themselves. For years and years and years, they've been saying all of this is so important that we can't possibly let it slide. And then in order to get re-elected next time, they're willing to spend any amount of money.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is they may well not get re-elected. Well,
it may well not work.
Yeah.
Because in actual fact, because you don't control interest rates and you don't control the value of the pound, because the pound floats, it didn't used to float in the 1970s, the rate was set. The speculators' money for old rope, if they sense blood in the water, the George Soros is out there, will sell the pound.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to say, Martin, is that, and various commentators have said this, is that Truss is so bad that Starmer now stands a quite a good chance of winning.
Well, Starmer is clearly the sensible candidate, you know. He's not promising. I mean, from my point of view, he's being incredibly, you know, I keep forgetting her name, Rachel Reeves, the shadow chancellor, is saying, well, we can't renationalise things, we can't do anything ambitious because we've got no money. That is wrong. But of course, what the Tories
doesn't doing, understand that, that's not doing, very good, is it?
It doesn't matter about money, we're just going to borrow it.
Now, if the
Labour Party can say, well, hang on, if you're just going to borrow it, we could borrow it, but we might spend it on something different. We wouldn't spend it on tax cuts for the wealthiest, for example. Where is the case since 2008 for any tax cuts for wealthy people, after those wealthy people were bailed out by the wider taxpayer?
Well, look, Martin, you're bringing us on to the next clip from Liz Truss here with the Chris Mason interview, and that is looking at bankers' bonuses.
Lots of families at the moment are really struggling, and they'll see that one of the things you're happy to see happen is for bankers to get bigger bonuses. Whose side are you on?
What I want to see is a growing economy, so everybody in our country has the high-paid jobs that they deserve, that the investment into their town or city or area, the new businesses being set up. That's the kind of Britain that I want to see.
And that means the rich get richer, that's fine.
If that means taking difficult decisions, which are going to help Britain become more competitive, help Britain become more attractive, help more investment flow into our country, yes, I'm absolutely prepared to take those decisions, because what I care about is I care about our country being successful and everyone in our country, wherever they live, wherever they're from, having those opportunities.
So you're willing to do unpopular things if you think it can contribute to a bigger economy?
That's right. And I will always work to make sure that we are helping those who are struggling. That's why we took the action that we took on energy bills, because we didn't want to see households facing unaffordable bills. And that's why we're going to take the action on national insurance and reversing that increase as well. So yes, we do have to take difficult decisions to get our economy growing. We have to look at our tax rates. So corporation tax needs to be competitive with other countries so that we can attract that investment. But ultimately, the reason I'm doing that, and the reason the Chancellor is doing that, is because we want people across this country to have those opportunities. That's why we're doing it.
So, I do wonder if she's just a kind of crash and burn Prime Minister, because she doesn't sound like she stands a cat in hell's chance of actually getting actually spreading wealth around. She seems like she's doing is she's concentrating more and more of it away from the poor towards the rich. There's an article this week by Sean O'Grady in The Independent. He suggests, well, Truss is risking killing the economy and the Tory party in one blow.
Yeah, but as you say, don't forget there's all of these think tankers who are now in the cabinet and advising her. Very good article by George Monbiot in today's Guardian about the people around her. And they've always wanted this low tax, low regulation theory. You know, this is their theory that if we haven't done enough of this, that this will somehow make the economy grow. So they've got this idea that if you cut taxes for the wealthy, the economy grows so much as a result of that, that you then for get more money back in taxes, even though the tax rate is lower. It's called the Laffer curve, which is actually a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph in the 1980s. And when I used to teach A-level economics in the 1980s, I used to call it the laughable Laffer curve, because there's not a shred of evidence that cutting taxes for wealthy people grows the economy faster than you lose money by not taking their money.
What about this? I mean, he uses this term trussonomics. So far as can be judged, he says, It requires a huge leap of faith in the ability of tax cuts and supply-side reforms to unleash a wave of economic revival.
Yes, it's basically that old-time religion. You know, the entrepreneurs are just going to grow like mushrooms, and they're going to set up all of these new businesses, and then the economy will boom and everything will be great, except there's no evidence whatsoever since 1979, and of course the crash of 2008, this philosophy is just wrong. In the early days, you could say, well, let's give it a go and see what might happen. None of my tutors at university would have regarded it as any way serious. But let's just imagine that people who didn't know much about it said, well, let's give it a go. We've given it a go for 40 years. It's not worked in 40 years. And the problem politically for her is going to be that the economy is going to crash. So far from creating economic growth, which she can then, you know, promise to tell everybody that things are getting better, it's actually going to go down the drain.
Well, and maybe it is.
Even if you did get economic growth, for the majority of people, they're going to be worse off. So it doesn't make any difference to them, does it?
It's not proper economics, as you were taught it, this trussonomics. Apparently, it also means running fiscal and monetary policy in opposite directions. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is the Bank of England, because it's independent and it was set up during the neoliberal era, their only target is to keep inflation under control. Unlike the Federal Reserve in the US, for example, which also has, in theory, to look towards employment. Although there's a big difference between the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England. The Bank of England is actually part of the government, as the Federal Reserve is actually controlled directly by the private banking cartels. But one of the things Liz Truss was suggesting during the Conservative leadership campaign is that she might get rid of the independence of the Bank of England and get, I mean, she's just sacked the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and that shocked the Treasury completely. So in other words, what she's doing is saying all that stuff for 40 years about balancing the books, that's a load of rubbish. Now, actually, it is a load of rubbish, but it's astonishing that people like her and Jacob Rees-Mogg have suddenly realised that you don't have to balance the books.
No, you can actually just borrow. You can borrow loads of money and give it to your mates and the super rich and the oil companies.
That's right. And what's not to like? Even if the Tories lose the next election, those people will walk away with loot.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we're going to hear from Catherine Austin Fitz later on and her take on what they're doing. So anyway, the fiscal boost, he says, from tax cuts and public spending will push inflation up. The bank will have to raise interest rates to get the spending power back out of the economy to bring inflation back to their 2% target. The bigger the tax cuts, the bigger the rate rises. This means maybe a slump, bankruptcies, housing crash, destitution. And also for people with big mortgages, the same. Or the dash for growth will work and output will soar. So which is it going to be?
I think the former. There's too many deflationary pressures in the global economy. The debt bubble, the everything bubble is going to burst. It may burst first of all in Britain. And I think that will be an indication of the particularly incompetent leadership we have had. But it's going to burst anyway, everywhere. And of course, big countries like Russia and China are preparing to weather that storm. And they're probably in a better condition to weather that storm than we are. There's a very interesting article by Adam Tooze in The Guardian today. He's an economic historian. If the Chinese are able to stabilise their economy, then the Australian economy will probably be all right. But everybody else is going down the tubes. Europe is definitely going down the tubes. And like it or not, Britain is in Europe. We're going down the tubes.
So also she was questioned about the falling value of the pound and asked about Ukraine too.
How worried are you about a falling pound, falling the value of the pound?
Well, my belief is that Britain's economic fundamentals are strong. We have relatively low debt compared to the rest of the G7. We have strong employment, although we do need to help more people who are currently economically inactive go into work. We have a great enterprise culture. We have a fantastic
value of the pound.
Well, what I'm about is getting those economic fundamentals right. And what the Chancellor will be outlining on Friday is his approach, showing that we are fiscally responsible. We're going to carry out our policies in a fiscally responsible way. And we are going to help make the United Kingdom more competitive and more successful.
The pound has been tumbling, interest rates are rising, some prices are soaring. Do you accept that despite your interventions, times are going to be tough for people this winter?
We're facing incredibly tough economic times. I'm here in New York at the United Nations. We've had the invasion of Ukraine, which has pushed up energy prices. We're still seeing the after effects of COVID. And what is very important, as well as growing our economy, we're also protecting our economic security. We're making sure we back the Ukrainians, and I'm determined to make sure we back them for the long haul, because we cannot see Russia succeed. But we also need to make sure we're more energy independent, and we're less dependent on those authoritarian regimes. So it's about economic growth, but it's also about economic security. And what I'm going to be doing over the coming days is talking to our allies about how we can deepen those ties with each other so we can work together to make sure we have that security.
Last question. In what way will you be a different Prime Minister from Boris Johnson?
Well, I will be my own Prime Minister. And I wouldn't compare myself to any predecessors, and the times we're in are different from the times predecessors have been in. We are entering a new era. It is a more insecure era. We face an increasingly aggressive Russia, an assertive China. We need to work more closely with our allies, and we also need to get the British economy growing so that we have that security for all of our citizens. And what I'm about, and what my government is about delivering for people, making sure that people have the jobs, the opportunities, and the future that they can rely on.
UK Prime Minister Liz Truss there speaking to our political editor, Chris Mason.
And if he uses the word, I'm going to deliver, once more, I'm going to start a petition to ask Chris Mason to give her a prod every time she does that, because it's quite annoying. This word deliver. She seems to have sort of had it programmed into her like a computer. But anyway, what she's saying there, Martin, is actually this is largely all, pretty much all, you know, the fall in the value of the pound is Russia's fault.
Well, there's a fundamental problem with that analysis, which is it's not the Russians that have caused the problem. They are prepared to sell their energy cheaper than world market prices to the West. It's the West that said they don't want that. And that's the reason why the prices are going up. And that's the fundamental reason. And that's because they want to put sanctions on Russia to stop them doing what they're doing in the Ukraine. Well, there's a price to be paid for that. And if there were an honest government, like in the 1950s when we went to war in Korea, they would turn around to the wealthy classes in this country and say, if you want to go to war in Korea to defeat the Chinese communists, I'm afraid the top rate of tax is going to have to remain at 95% so that we can balance the books and defeat the communists and build a health service to make sure our own people are happy. They're not doing that. They're saying we're going to war with Russia. We're not going to. That's effectively what she's saying. We're not going to have a wartime economy. We're going to give wealthy people a big tax cut so that they can have a nice time. Meanwhile, the poor people are going to pay the price for all of this. And of course, delivery. The problem with what's going to happen is the economy is going to go down, not up, down. And therefore, all of that stuff, even people who are not educated about economics, are just going to see through that straight away. Because in actual fact, if the economy is shrinking, then all this stuff is going to help us have a growing economy. Even the stupidest people will be able to see that ain't right.
There's also an announcement about fracking this week. That is to say, now they're going to start fracking again. It's extremely bad for the water table, for the aquifers, these horrible chemicals getting into our water supply. And the most, I suppose, the obvious thing to say is that the Conservatives were elected on a promise to never do this again. And this was part of the election manifesto.
Yes. Do you know what, Tony? It may be a surprise to you, but they often tell fibs.
How useful will fracking actually be? As far as I can see, it doesn't produce marginal. Much gas at all.
It's marginal. The fracking lobby will be happy with this. But some of those people will make money. But in terms of solving the fundamental problems, it's a non-starter. It's totally marginal.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn. We got both of the brothers on today's show. Jeremy Corbyn speaking in the Commons this week about the damage to the water table that, and he's talking here to the business secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, at a fracking debate in Parliament. And he starts off by explaining, Corbyn, his question is about this poisoning of the water supply, which is a great point to make.
To introduce fracking back into this country. Surely he must understand the dangers of this are going to be here for decades and decades to come, long after whatever small amounts of gas have been extracted, and it's future generations that will suffer because of this policy.
Mr. Speaker, it's no surprise that I disagree with the Right Honourable Gentleman. I would refer him to the 2012 report that was done that went through this and went through what had happened in the United States for comparison purposes. First of all, it found that the evidence on pollution of aquifers was not actually any good, that most of the stories were invented or were scare stories. But in addition to that, the UK has a very good regulatory regime. So the combination of ignoring the scare stories and decent regulation means that one can be confident that aquifers will not be damaged.
Amy Callaghan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Coming back to the 2019 Tory Party manifesto, which each member opposite stood on, it states a moratorium on fracking would only be lifted, and I quote from page 55, unless science says it shows it can be done safely. A change in Tory party leadership is not a change in scientific evidence. Can the Secretary of State enlighten the House as to why the government thinks they are both above logic and above science?
Because all the evidence is that it can be done safely, as it is in the United States, and as the 2012 report that I've referred to many times indicated.
Well, if you've had a look at any of the fracking documentaries, you'll see, of course, it's not at all safe in the United States. I mean, he really does take the biscuit, doesn't he, old Jacob? He's talking about, well, actually, the stories of poisoning the water are just scare stories. They're not real. Well, that's a lie. And also he's saying that the Brits here have got good water regulation. Well, we know that's nonsense from the fiasco in the summer, with particularly with the sewage and the mega profits from the water companies, the private water companies.
Well, yes. I mean, it's the sheer brass neck, isn't it? They stood on a manifesto the last time they stood, where they got 43% of the vote, probably shouldn't have been the government. But in that, they said that, they promised people there'd be no more fracking. Now, of course, it may be that public opinion has moved along because of all of this anti-Russian propaganda. Well, we wouldn't frack before, but now we're at war with Russia. Maybe we need to do a bit of fracking. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't change anything. The international market for gas and oil is dominated by political decisions, like the political decision of the West not to buy Russian gas and oil, even though it's by far the most straightforward and easiest thing for them to do. But they've decided they don't want to do that, which would require them to compromise with the Russians. They're not prepared to do that. We're not prepared to compromise with the Chinese. We're not prepared to compromise with anybody. That is actually saying we're going to go to war. Now, if you're going to go to war, in actual fact, you've got to start planning things. It's not the free market anymore. You've got to have very high taxes. Corporation tax has to go up. The wealthy have to pay. And the reason you justify that in wartime is you say the boys are dying. They're bleeding. Therefore, you must pay more taxes. What's really, really disgusting about this is that they're talking war and they're also promising the wealthy a big party at the same time. That's disgusting.
Yeah, well, you say it wouldn't change anything, fracking. One thing it would change is that we'd all have to, well, not all of us, but many people would have to start going, buying bottled water, because if you drink water from a well or from a spring, it might poison you and you might die. So that certainly would be a change if they decide to go down this route. And I'm quite heartened to see that many of these anti-fracking campaigners this week are mobilising, getting their camper vans ready and whatever to get out there to stop this. And I think, isn't it Quadrilla? I think I'm right in saying is one of those biggest companies out there. It's said that the problems with earthquakes, I mean, they were part of the reason that the Tories decided to stop this, because there were so many of these earthquakes going on as they were. Because the geology of Britain is not the same as the US.
No, and in the US, in actual fact, the fracking boom is an entirely artificial boom. because they don't want to buy oil from Venezuela. They don't want to buy oil from Iran. They don't want to buy oil from Russia. So therefore, they have to frack their own national parks. But in actual fact, it would be quite straightforward to have a rational policy for oil and gas for the whole world. But we'd have to actually just get on with each other instead of being daggers drawn. And of course, that's the fundamental problem, is that the Western powers, which have dominated the geopolitical system for the last 500 years, do not want to let go of that bone. And that's why we're going into this crisis that we're going into, because the rest of the world's had enough of it.
Spectacular stuff on Al Jazeera at the moment. That is last night, and tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. We've got the same program on Al Jazeera English, and I think it's so that'd be Saturday night as well as Monday night. So this is a bit like the lobby that they did a few years ago, spread over different nights of the same week. But I was watching this program last night, Martin, thinking, good God, this is like watching World in Action from the late 70s. It's a really hard-nosed political investigation. The most amazing thing about it, really, is that you cannot these films, these programs are just it's impossible to make them in Britain anymore. ITV, Channel 4, BBC are all conspiring to stop these being produced nowadays.
Well, yes. And of course, whole perfectly legitimate news outlets like RT, you can't even get it on the internet.
Well, that's the sort of thing that used to do it. Can you just give us a bit of background to this scandal, though? Because it's basically the party discord during the Corbyn years, apparently, really effectively stopped Jeremy Corbyn becoming, never mind what the right-wing media did during the time, stopped Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister potentially in 2017. In fact, it's quite likely he would have made it if it wasn't for these moles within his own party.
And presumably that's what this documentary is about. I didn't see it, Tony. You've got to tell me.
Oh, OK. Well, let's have a listen now to a news report from Al Jazeera about their own documentary. Al Jazeera's leaked UK Labour Party files exposed party discord during the Corbyn era. Well, that's putting it mildly. Let's have a listen now.
The documents provide an insight into the workings of the party when it was led by Jeremy Corbyn.
Build bridges, not walls.
When he became leader, party membership doubled.
The wonderful campaign that I was involved with brought a lot of people back into politics because they believed there was something on offer for them.
But Corbyn did not control the party bureaucracy based in its London headquarters. The files show how unelected officials undermined him as leader. The leak includes a WhatsApp group of senior party management discussing Corbyn.
I'm just about to stab him.
That might be disciplinary.
Worth it, though.
Nothing in the rules about stabbing. Poor form, though.
The files show how officials used the party's disciplinary process to suspend local branches that supported Corbyn. In Wallasey, in the northwest of England, allegations of homophobic abuse were levelled at pro-Corbyn supporters after a meeting in June 2016.
I did not see any limp wrist gestures, and there were no homophobic comments made about the MP.
The story was leaked to the national media and used to suspend the local Wallasey party.
If you have an inner core of 6, 8 or 10 people nationally saying who can be a candidate, saying who can be a member, then you control the body politic of one of the major parties in this country. And I find that is undemocratic. Basically, it's a coup by a group of people to take over one of the major political parties in Britain.
In Brighton, on England's south coast, Labour's legal unit is intent on overturning the victory of the pro-Corbyn faction at an annual general meeting.
We all had 65% of the vote. 2 in 3 people attending it, a record turnout, a record majority, had won. Fantastic.
A member of the party's governance and legal unit writes to her boss.
What's your feeling on Brighton?
The head of the legal unit replies.
Exactly what you proposed. Overturn the annual general meeting, deal with individuals, while we worry about applying the rules correctly and legal niceties.
The woman answers.
I say act now and worry about those things later.
The Labour Party denies this version of events. It says it's a rules-based organisation that properly followed its own rules. The files also reveal how abusive messaging is used by those outside the party hierarchy to discredit rivals. Pro-Corbyn supporter Damien McCarthy is attacked online, and then his father is sent a dossier including the threatening tweets.
The dossier was sent through to my pa's, my stepdad, my pa's private email address. And that dossier was horrendous reading. It was awful. My dad read those terrible comments and he was upset about that. And he died not long after that.
Phil Rees, Al Jazeera, London.
These many of these smears, Martin, were just simply made up. I mean, there's nothing actually happened at a meeting, and yet the media were fed a load of information that there'd been homophobic abuse, that sort of thing, and racist abuse at a meeting, which the people who were there said, well, there was nothing, you know, nothing happened at all. This was all just a complete and utter fabrication. And it's obviously they were talking there about this whole idea of, well, let's get this person out of the party now and then we'll worry about whether it's legal later.
Yes, and of course, I mean, I'm now aware of what this Al Jazeera documentary is about, and of course I'm not unaware of all of these things. What you've got to understand is that the Labour Party is quite a complex institution, and certainly the main infrastructure of it, the full-time staff, are controlled by the intelligence services. They always have been. And therefore, they are there to make sure that things go the right way. The same thing with the Democrat Party in the US. What the so-called Russiagate email showed was that the full-time officials were, in defiance of the actual rule book, making sure that Bernie Sanders didn't become the candidate. And therefore, when people say they live in a democratic society in Britain or the US, that's just largely flim-flam. In actual fact, the Tories or the Republicans are the default party of government, and the other Democrats or Labour Party are only allowed to get a sniff of any kind of power once they've been suitably purged of anybody who's going to do anything to upset the oligarchy. And this has been going on for years. It's not just a new thing, but it became very intense during the Corbyn era because Corbyn was able to mount a challenge to that way of doing things, which they found very, very threatening. And it's quite clear that many on the right of the party, including MPs, many of them with very pro-Israeli sympathies, would rather lose the election and let the Tories win than have Corbyn as prime minister. Now, that is why we need PR and why countries like Ireland broke out of the United Kingdom in the 1920s, because they're fed up of being told what to do by these kind of people.
So I also spoke to Kevin Carhill, who's a regular on this show. He's author of several books, Who Owns Britain, Who Owns the World, Who Owns Ireland, is his latest one. I spoke to Kevin about particularly about the sort of constitutional changes that are going on at the moment. Kevin has got a very good knowledge of the. I know it's a bit unfair, Martin, but I'm going to quiz you. Do you know how much, how big the Crown Estate is? How many acres? Do you want to guess?
Oh, I've no idea because obviously it doesn't just. Are we talking just about the United Kingdom?
Yeah.
This is
the Crown Estate, which is officially the farms and things and the villages where. The Crown, which I'm pretty sure includes the Duchy of Lancaster too, takes the rent for those properties.
And the Duchy of Cornwall, yeah.
No, it's actually not. It excludes the Duchy of Cornwall. It's just.
Well, but your bankers don't include that.
This is what's happened, basically, as Charles has
become. They exclude it, but I mean, it belongs to the royal family. It doesn't belong directly to the Queen.
The Crown Estate is directly controlled by the monarch, even though they sometimes
As I understand it, is the mineral rights to everything on our continental shelf.
Well, you know, this is another fascinating thing. We talk about this a little bit. I don't want to preempt it too much, but you know, the royals own the seabed, so it's not entirely surprising that we see Prince Charles applauding every time there's a new wind farm built out in the ocean. Anyway, let's listen to Kevin's take on this whole energy move towards fracking, and also. Looking at Prince Charles's, what is, just a bit short of 500,000 acres of Crown Estate.
Well, the company that was the biggest, you know, the first quadrilla, the one that was all for fracking, has actually said fracking doesn't work in the UK. The geology is too fractured and it doesn't work. And that should have always been visible. In North America, there were vast, you know, prairies and all sorts of things. But here, it's an urban country, largely. And you can move almost nothing on scale without affecting, causing small earthquakes. So he's on a good one there. But the other thing, the Guardian have run a series recently on the hidden hand of the monarchy in relation to Acts of Parliament. It's never been declared properly where the Crown says, we have an interest. You know, it hasn't been publicly disclosed. And
Rob Evans, I think, isn't it?
That's right. And that needs to change. And again, I feel that from what we've heard, that Charles A will up his green agenda and B would have no trouble saying, fine, you know, if we make an intervention, it shall be public.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, isn't it, that the Crown has got the right to actually call in a law if it affects the monarchy and alter it before it passes it into law.
Well, where it becomes really sensitive and tricky is when the ownership is uncertain. You know, if a law affects the Crown estate, who does it affect? The manager, which is the government, or the owner, which is the king? You know, there's all this confusion, and the purpose of the confusion in the end is to make sure the ordinary public know nothing and understand nothing.
What do you think is the future for the Crown Estate? And it is massive, isn't it? Do you know how many acres it is altogether?
God, yeah, 145. No, that's the Duchy of Cornwall. The Crown Estate is about 400,000 acres. But again, the measurement of the acres is very imprecise. The Crown Estate owns some of the foreshore, but it's not listed which bits. You know, it's leased off bits to ports and it's leased off bits to farmers and fishermen and all sorts of things.
Well, it's also the bed of the North Sea and the seabed is starting to lease off now for these wind farms, the tidal up in the north of Scotland, the tidal power system, and of course things like North Sea oil.
Yeah, the way leaves, as they call them, that is the rent you pay if you run a cable out to a wind generator. That goes to the Crown Estate, and the Crown Estate is now making extremely serious money out of the way leaves. Again, all this needs to be part of the public discussion.
Well, it is interesting because Charles has been pushing this whole idea of wind farms at sea for a long time, which he stands to personally benefit from.
That is it. You know, who's benefiting? And in a certain kind of crisis, the government could abandon its management of the Crown Estate and give it back to King Charles. Then he would get it all. Tax-free.
Yeah. Yes, sorry. tax-free. He comes in with a bang at the end there, tax-free. And it is, of course, you know, this is the way that that it works here, is that if there's anything in a law that's being passed which affects the monarch, they have a right to just put a line through it before it gets the royal assent, Martin.
Yes, and the fact was that we didn't know about that until relatively recently.
Well, that's so, right, Rob Evans, The Guardian, has done a fantastic job.
Yeah, that's right, but why didn't we know that? I mean, these are factual things.
Well, there's a lot we don't know.
In other words, people thought that the government of the day made the laws and the Queen just signed them. And it turns out that they got a look at all of these laws before they were signed and they were able to take things out. And one of the things that it came out was, the various ecological things that were supposed to be happening in Scotland. They managed to get the Crown Estates, not have to do those things. So it was completely contradictory to all the green rhetoric. But in any case, how is it in 21st century that the Crown can secretly change the law and we're not even allowed to know they're doing that?
Well, I know, it's mad, isn't it? It's a bit sort of barbaric, really. Well, there'll be a longer version of this interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with Kevin. But he wanted to stress the point particularly. It's not just about land. And he's, you know, Kevin does tend to do this, and I do it too. Focus on the things we really need to live. And also, of course, these things are a free gift to mankind originally. And now, of course, we've got everybody is supposedly going to have to pay some wealthy landowner or whatever for them. But he also talks about the cost of water these days. So Kevin said, well, it's not just about land. You've also got to look at what's going on in the water business.
There's something else that's as essential as land, and that's water. We get water. Our water bills down here in the southwest are some of the highest in the world. And we got the worst pollution of our rivers. It's done by these people, and they charge us money for it. There's a basic kind of disconnect. We pay for people for one of the most vital things in life, water, and they turn around and dump sewage in rivers and on the beaches.
Well, I mean, up until the end of the Second World War, there were still tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that got their water from a well, Kevin, for free.
Yep. I lived in the village where we did. We had a pump, and you went up to the pump in the morning and you filled your bucket or your kettle. Yes, I remember that personally. But the situation now is
if you've got enough money, you can buy shares in your local water company and the dividends will pay the bill, so you never actually pay a bill.
Yep, and the dividends are enormous. And the salaries are obscene. If the people did their job, you might be able to justify it, but they don't. There were 300,000, more than 300,000, sewage pollution incidents last year. And, the government's busy beating up poor people and hammering them, and it's not hammering these people.
The amazing thing about the legacy of privatisation, Thatcher and all that, was not only incidents like the Camelford water disaster, where the first week that the privatisation people took over, they poisoned to death many people in this village in Cornwall.
Yeah.
I think it's in Cornwall.
Camelford.
Is the fact that if you're poor, you're basically paying for the rich's water.
Firstly, you're also paying for unsafe water. You know, the end of all this billions paid to shareholders isn't safe water. It's contaminated water. You know, you followed the Hillsborough disaster, didn't you? It took 25 years for the truth to come out, and the government rigidly blocked every attempt by anybody to have the people responsible and to stop blaming the fans. Our government has a completely mistaken notion of what its job is. And, for instance, it's too close to the Crown Estate. It's got too big an interest in it to actually straighten out the Crown Estate and make it, put it in the land registry, show all the bits of it, so that people can see what land is around. There's an artificial market in houses in Britain, and that's at the bottom of it. It's not a lack of land as such, but it would help if we knew where the land was and who owned it, but we don't.
Can you just run us through the books that you've done on, particularly on land ownership in Ireland and England and elsewhere?
Most of them are now on Amazon. The one that's in print and currently selling is Who Owns Ireland? And that's available Amazon.uk and other good booksellers. And but the Who Owns the World and Who Owns Britain and Ireland are out of print, but you can get them, and the prices are quite reasonable.
So yeah,
even I can afford to buy the odd one.
Okay. All right, Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. Great.
Yeah, so the full version of that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I find it quite amusing, Kevin having to buy copies of his own book from bookfinder.com or somewhere, you know, because it's so long out of print. It's in a tremendous amount of demand. I know copies of that Who Owns Britain were going for nearly £100. I think it was 80, 90 quid because it's such a fascinating gazetteer. But, I mean, the point he's making there, Martin, I think is clear about land being an artificial housing bubbles being created. It's not as if there isn't enough land. It's just that there's only a few in the clique that are actually allowed to build on it and sell houses.
Well, it's a fundamental part of the rentier economy in this country, isn't it? The landlord classes, and many Tory MPs are landlords, they determine the policy. And that's been true going back into history. And that's why we got such a distorted economy where, people who invest in real estate and the Duke of Westminster is the wealthiest man in the country and all the rest of it. But they don't have to do a stroke of work for that. As house prices rise, as land rises in value through the activities of other people making wealth, they just siphon off a huge, great chunk of it. And then they use that wealth to buy the political system so it carries on. And that's how we run it.
If you've got a spare £15,000 or £20,000, I'm not sure what the how much it is nowadays, but if you just buy shares in your local water company, the dividends pay your bills. So effectively, as I was saying there, we've got this horrific situation where the poorest are just simply paying their bills to provide the rich with free water.
Well, in actual fact, the cost of supplying water isn't per litre. If you live in a detached house in outside the city, putting the pipes in to supply water to you is far more expensive than supplying water to an inner city tower block. So the poor pay per litre and the rich pay per litre, but the actual infrastructure to get water out to the sticks is far more expensive, so they get subsidised by the poor. But what's not to like if you are the rich? In this country, things are run in the interests of the property-owning classes, and that's always been the way of it going back into history.
Well, I mean, I think I'm not so sure about that, because I think after World War II we had a genuine, attempt. Anyway, I mean, it was quite a successful attempt to redistribute wealth, to make sure that people weren't falling through the gaps. We heard last week, didn't we, from Farooq Sadiq from Bristol Pakistan Association, how Imran Khan over in Pakistan in the last few years, as guaranteed homeless people a roof over their heads, guaranteed the hungry food right across, in the big cities anyway, in Pakistan. This isn't impossible to do at all. It's just that there is a kind of schadenfreude there amongst the rich that they actually quite enjoy seeing poor people begging and starving.
Well, that's what Gore Vidal pointed out, that the rich can't enjoy their wealth unless the poor are punished and seen to be punished. And that's part of the buzz of being wealthy. But of course, there were reforms in that era, and a lot of them came as a result of two world wars. Because as I said earlier, if people are going to send their boys to die in Korea and they're not coming home, or they're going to come home with one leg or half a head, then actually the wealthy have got to put their money where their mouth is. If you want to fight this war, you are definitely paying for it. And of course, that attitude really was powerful. But of course, the wealthy always hated those reforms. Kaletsky, the Polish-British economist, said it's not that these reforms, the welfare state, Keynesian politics, all the rest of it, Keynesian economics, strong trade unions, it's not that they don't work, they do work. But the wealthy will ultimately undermine that, because they just want it like it used to be, the good old days. And that's where we've got. It's actually totally regressive and totally unnecessary, and none of it need to happen. But it's too, none of it should ever have happened. But it did happen, and we are where we are.
Where we are, and I think one of the reasons that the Queen's momentous funeral on Monday was so, I mean, there was just so many people. I actually got quite emotional, Martin. I'm sure you didn't, but I did. Seeing so many people turn out to line the route, coming from central London down the A4, down the A30, you know, to Windsor after the funeral service. And then there was another smaller service at St George's Chapel. I just get the impression, looking at it and chatting to some friends about it, that it wasn't just the Queen that died. It was almost this kind of post-war settlement that we're fighting for something in World War II. We're fighting for something afterwards to keep it going. This whole idea of some kind of fair society, whether it's a Christian society, as the Queen was a Christian, but at least some kind of equity out there where the rich do not stamp on the poor. Now, that's almost as if, I might be stretching a point, but it's almost as if that was also dying, and also died with the Queen on Monday, Martin.
I think that's a fair thing to say, because the Queen represented the continuity of World War II, and then she became the Queen, and that was the era of all of these social reforms, council houses, proper unemployment benefits, nationalised industries, and in the early 60s, and mid-60s, you know, the Beatles sang Her Majesty's a Pretty Nice Girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say, and all of that. That kind of idea of being a different kind of society, and the royal family being approachable, still respectable, but approachable and all the rest of it. And, you know, when anybody dies, those who are left alive have to consider their own mortality and their own life course and all the rest of it. That's what funerals are for.
I mean, I think it was quite interesting to see how much time and effort she had obviously put into her own funeral. There were some little characteristics in it. Obviously, the Scottish piping was amazing. But things like the hearse driving through a kind of little, almost like a kind of country B road. I've never seen anything quite like it, with this massive escort of guardsmen and pipers down the little B road near Windsor somewhere. And also, I think it's quite clear she was involved very much in the sermon. And we're going to hear the sermon now that Justin Welby preached in Westminster Abbey for the Queen on Monday. Because we're going to hear it because it's short, and the Queen apparently insisted on shorter and shorter sermons. She's saying, look, you know, it's a bit like her Christmas message, which we will really miss. I will certainly miss her Christmas message. It was short and sweet and to the point generally. And I think Charles is going to have a really difficult job to fill those boots. So let's have a listen now to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, on Monday, praising the Queen's service to the UK at her funeral.
The pattern for many leaders is to be exalted in life and forgotten after death. The pattern for all who serve God, famous or obscure, respected or ignored, is that death is the door to glory. Her late Majesty famously declared on a 21st birthday broadcast that her whole life would be dedicated to serving the nation and Commonwealth. Rarely has such a promise been so well kept. Few leaders receive the outpouring of love that we have seen. Jesus, who in our reading does not tell his disciples how to follow, but who to follow, said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Her late Majesty's example was not set through her position or her ambition, but through whom she followed. I know His Majesty shares the same faith and hope in Jesus Christ as his mother, the same sense of service and duty, In 1953, the Queen began her coronation with silent prayer, just there, at the high altar. Her allegiance to God was given before any person gave allegiance to her. Her service to so many people in this nation, the Commonwealth and the world, had its foundation in her following Christ, God Himself, who said that He came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many. People of loving service are rare in any walk of life. Leaders of loving service are still rarer. But in all cases, those who serve will be loved and remembered when those who cling to power and privileges are long forgotten. The grief of this day, felt not only by the late Queen's family, but all round the nation, the Commonwealth and the world, arises from her abundant life and loving service, now gone from us. She was joyful, present to so many, touching a multitude of lives. And we pray today especially for all her family, grieving as every family at a funeral, including so many families round the world who have themselves lost someone recently. But in this family's case, doing so in the brightest spotlight. May God heal their sorrow. May the gap left in their lives be marked with memories of joy and life. Her late Majesty's broadcast during COVID lockdown ended with, "We will meet again." Words of hope from a song of Vera Lynn. Christian hope means certain expectation of something not yet seen. Christ rose from the dead and offers life to all, abundant life now, and life with God in eternity. As the Christmas carol says, where meek souls will receive him, still the dear Christ enters in. We will all face the merciful judgment of God. We can all share the Queen's hope, which in life and death inspired her servant leadership. Service in life, hope in death. All who follow the Queen's example and inspiration of trust and faith in God can with her say, "We will meet again."
So 5.5 minutes from Justin Welby. Not bad for a sermon, Martin.
No, I mean, as you say, blessedly short compared to some sermons. Of course,
a lot of social justice in there, wasn't there? And also, I think this is fascinating, this whole concept of leadership. So, you know, those that cling to power are the ones we forget about. But, you know, I think there's definitely some messages for the next generation, not just King Charles, but William too.
Well, I mean, I'm loath to say negative things about the recently dead. So let's just leave it at that. Although I would point out that she is unique amongst monarchs in being the head of her own church. And that, of course, is to do with Henry VIII and a little floozy called Anne Boleyn. And that is another bit of quirky bit of British history, eh?
It is, isn't it? And I mean, I don't know about Charles and his faith. So far as I can tell, he's more of a pantheist and he wants to embrace all different faiths He wants to be the defender of the faiths, apparently, rather than the Christian faith.
Well, it's not just the Christian faith, it's the Anglican faith. This was the important thing at the time. Right. And it's one of the things that led to the civil wars in our country not long afterwards.
Well, I mean, another thing which has come
up, you know, the Anglicans were not necessarily the majority in the British Isles, and lots.
Well, I mean, I wonder, of course, whether these various people giving sermons and the one the committal proceeding, well, the committal anyway, whatever it was, at St George's Chapel, are now about to get their marching orders, because of course all these people have been basically put on notice. And certainly all the staff at the various palaces have been put on notice now, because once Charles takes over, there's an enormous great rehiring, and apparently he's going to slim everything down. So, you know, I don't know quite how long Welby's got to go, but the next one will be chosen by Charles, and the same right across the Church of England.
Well, I mean, although in theory the monarch chooses the Archbishop of Canterbury, they do it on the advice of the Church of England.
Yeah, but you try getting on that list if you're not, you know, in Charles's favour. I mean, this is I think that so much of this country runs like this. It's like a kind of clique, really.
Well, it is, and the argument is that it seems irrational and silly, but at least it works. We're going to be testing that to destruction.
Well, yes, exactly. Anyway, I think the lesson from the funeral for me was to see the so many people turning out to they lay the flowers beforehand and march through the lying in state in Westminster Hall, and the sense that something else was dying, not just the Queen. So in terms of the social justice and the fight back, we're going to go and have a listen now to Tuesday evening in Bristol at St George's, up Park Street, just off Park Street, with Barry West. And he's the South West Regional Organiser of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Unions. Now, this is the launch of Enough is Enough. That's a bit, most major cities across the country are having or have had this group, Enough is Enough, launching there. And so let's have a listen to his opening. But basically Barry, as the South West Regional Organiser of the RMT, these guys are kind of the spearhead. And we'll hear from Martin after we've heard from Barry West, South West Regional Organiser of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, speaking in Bristol this week.
It's a real privilege, actually, to be able to come and speak to you tonight from the RMT Union. I bring our fraternal greetings and solidarity to all working people in this city and across the UK who are currently fighting to face and fight this cost of living crisis. We know we're looking at a cliff edge, even with the money that Liz Truss is so kindly going to put into the economy to help us, or put into the bank accounts of her friends in big business, as we know. Effectively, for working class people, that cliff edge remains. And for millions of workers, that's what we're facing this winter, this Christmas, and into the new year. As I said, it's a great honour to be able to speak tonight, and we've affiliated to Enough is Enough, and I think the slogan itself actually resonates with people greatly across the UK, because people have had enough. The only people that don't seem to have enough are the rich and the people who own the wealth. They never seem to have enough, and they all seem to want more at our expense. The strength of this meeting tonight, and meeting apparently outside of Brandon Hill as well, is a reflection of this growing movement. And I warmly applaud Acorn, the CW, and the other organisations who've started this campaign, and there's no doubt it's echoing throughout the country. And I believe sincerely that a lot of the decision to put that extra money, even though it's inadequate, to pay off some of the bills for energy, is because they realise of this mass campaign that built it. But that's not enough for us, comrades. We have to continue to build this campaign. There's a lot of angry people out there. If we had all the angry people in Bristol here tonight, we could overflow this meeting 1,000 times over, as we know. This campaign, the trade unions, we do have to get into the working class estates in Bristol and across the country. We know that millions of workers lack the confidence or the organisation at the current moment to act and to fight back. But hopefully this year, when we took our first week of strike action in the RMT, something happened which we didn't realise. The industrial landscape across the United Kingdom, I think, changed in that week, because people seen, and we hadn't expected that, but people seen that there was a union prepared to take national action against the employers and against the government effectively, because the government are controlling and running dispute against rail workers. We all know that, and that is who we're fighting. But we're not afraid of that, and I think the reason why our dispute has resonated with millions of people because people have seen, as a trade union and our leadership and the way they've spoken, aren't fearful about speaking up for working people. We're not doffing our hat, we're not going in begging. We're demanding. We're demanding, and we have a right to demand it. Demanding that 2.7 million people using food banks is a disgrace and obscene. 2 million workers report skipping meals because of money and because they go hungry because they have to pay other bills. 1.2 million taking out payday loans for essentials. And the bottom 20% of the population disposable income is only £12,798. That's £35 a day. If you've got a family as a household, that's impossible. It was impossible before the pandemic, during the pandemic. It's going to be tenfold impossible once the bills start coming in for energy, and once food costs continue to rise and petrol continues to rise as well. This is an obscene crisis. It's not our making. I was asked earlier on by a reporter, do we feel that we're going back to the 1970s and we're going to create a wage inflation spiral? This crisis is not our fault.
Yes.
So that's the beginning of the much longer than the sermon, the speech by Barry West. This week in Bristol, Martin, for this organisation campaign called Enough is Enough. He's saying there this thing about, well, it's, you know, 1.2, it's not just about the rail workers. They're seeing, well, you know, if they do what they want to sack all these rail workers and pay them peanuts, then they're going to be on the dole with loads of other people. They're saying there's 1.2 million who are taking out payday loans to buy basic essentials, that families are having to live with all the bills and everything else on £35 a day to feed the kids and everything. And we've got 2.7 million pushing 3 million on food banks.
Well, I mean, obviously, that's all very much to the point. I must admit, I smiled a bit when he was talking about, and our messages echoing around the country, because obviously that clip was quite echoey because it was at a big hall. I think what I hope is happening is what used to be called in Italy ricomposizione di class, the recomposition of class consciousness, because in the 70s people knew that the gaffers didn't have your best interests at heart. And when people went on strike, people generally sympathised with those who were on strike, because they'd realised that people aren't going on strike for no reason. There's a reason for them to be on strike. And that was the kind of culture in this country, which was a result of all of the struggles that had gone previously. And of course, what's happened since then is a deliberate attempt to atomise people, to make them think only in terms of their own interests, their own family. And one of the, in the recent disputes, one of the rail workers, I think it was, said a woman came up to him on the picket line and said, "My wages are going down, but I'm not going on strike." And he said to her, "Well, you should." And I think that is the message that needs to get home here. There's no the government are actually talking about bringing in anti-strike legislation to prevent strikes, which is actually completely out with international labour legislation and so on. Now, if they do that, I think it's absolutely incumbent on everybody to back people who do go on strike, because these are fundamental issues. And ultimately, of course, we need strong trade unions. Strong trade unions were really important during that era in the 40s, 50s and 60s when life was transformed for ordinary people. And strong trade unions were very much part of that. And we've just got to get back there.
This mini budget day is supposed to be dealing with all of this. And of course, it's, as we've discussed earlier, it's actually, it seems, funneling more and more wealth towards the rich, hoping that the rich will spend it somehow into the economy, which of course we know they don't. They just squirrel it away in tax havens. So the mini budget 2022, that's today. The pound has been crashing, apparently, as the Chancellor from the Pinay Circle cuts stamp duty and top rate of income tax. So apparently there's been a bit of a I'm just reading this now on The Guardian, and it's saying that the mini budget could potentially create a run on the pound. The announcement has caught investors off guard. The programme set out this morning is destabilising to UK government finances, could create a run on the pound.
Well, that's obviously likely to happen. That's the big flaw in, hey, let's just have a party, which is what for wealthy people, which is effectively what's going on there. Incidentally, if this was a proper mini budget, the Office of Budget Responsibility that was set up by the Conservatives would have to run the figures through their computers and point out what was wrong with it. But of course, what they've done is, this isn't a mini budget, it's just an emergency statement. So the Office of Budget Responsibility haven't been told to run it through their computers and say what's the matter with it. Of course, other think tanks have. And the problem is that you can, I've got no problem with borrowing money, provided you spend it on stuff which is going to help ordinary people.
Well, I mean, Martin, what do you think is the significance of this? Because we've just heard today that the sterling has tumbled by over 3 cents to a 37-year low. It's now $1.09 to the pound. And yesterday it was $1.12.
Well, what's going to happen is, once the speculators sense that the government, you see, this is what George Soros did on Black Wednesday. Eventually, had Norman Lamont had to increase interest rates to 15% to try and salvage the pound's value.
So, I mean, we could be possibly even looking at parity with the dollar by the end of the week.
Absolutely. And of course, what that means is, effectively, if you want to salvage the current, this is why you can't just make your policy in your country.
Doesn't it just mean that British
might do? Because you're embedded in an international system, which is why you can say, well, if we've got Brexit, we can do what we like. We can reduce bankers' bonuses. We can do this, that and the other. But then your currency is then up for grabs. People, it's money for old rope. If all the currency speculators decide to sell the pound, whatever the real value of the pound may or may not be on the fundamentals doesn't really matter anymore, because they can make money by selling it, and they will carry on selling it until interest rates are raised and the economy is then trashed. Now, what happened on Black Wednesday was the pound was overvalued because they were trying to get into the ERM, and actually the reduction in the value of the pound was actually positive, because it ultimately led to an expansion of exports. The problem is that we don't actually export anything much anymore, and the market doesn't work like that. What happens when you lower the pound is that your import value, the price of your imports goes up, and that increases inflation. But it doesn't do anything to help your exports, because you don't export anything, because you don't do that anymore. You've killed all those industries.
Well, I mean, surely it means that British exports are going to be cheaper if the pound's...
Yes, it is. And those exports, if we had an export industry, then that would work. But we haven't got one.
No, we don't. No.
Because we've become a flim-flam economy where all we do is drag money from all over the world into the City of London and put it through our washing machines.
I mean, it's not impossible, is it, that there could be a complete run on the pound, and that distrust could have just created a massive disaster?
Well, it could well be the case, especially if they rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, which means that therefore we would then be moving towards a situation where the other European countries would say, well, you can't have access to the single market at all. Yeah. And at that point, speculators are onto hiding to nothing. They're just going to sell the pound until the Bank of England raises interest rates enough to crash the economy. And as I've always said this to you, Tony, what may happen, because of the incompetence of the particular leadership we have in this country, we may have a British crash, yeah, which then precipitates a global crash.
Well, yes, and it could be that it isn't actually incompetence, that there's an element of deliberateness about this, because, of course, this is a casino we're talking about here.
It is. And, of course, there is always people who can make money out. I mean, the speculators who are going to bet against the pound are all in the City of London, who have just been given tax cuts and a reduction and an increase in their bonuses.
Anyway, look,
they will sell the pound if they can make more money out of that.
Enough about them. Let's go back to Barry West at the RMT and hear the end of his speech this week on Tuesday in Bristol, the launch of Enough is Enough in the City. That's Barry West from the RMT.
I don't want to see my children and my grandchildren having to face these same battles in 50 years' time. Because if we don't change society, and just one comment on that, because I know Suzanne kindly read out the list of the demands for this campaign, but I have to say it reads a little bit like a shortlist. It could be a lot longer list, actually, of the opportunity we had in 2017 and 19 to pass those demands. Mistake again, not to become one of the media, the millionaire media, by the way, and the bosses. We got conned out of government. That all those things would have been, if you like, a list of achievements for that Labour government that would have been in power now, because they would have stopped those things. We'd have had decent housing. Energy bills would have been capped because they would have been nationalised. We would have begin have decent housing, ending food poverty, and have decent pay rises. Now, I don't think that would have been easy for a Corbyn government, and we would have faced opposition from the rest of the powerful establishment. And we've seen them on show in the last few weeks, haven't we? So I would say, at this meeting, we need to look forward and unite as a class. We need to believe in our own, as our union does, as a socialist united union, saying that we just don't need to change the government, we just don't need to change the employers. We do need to change society, and we need to learn our lessons from history on that.
That's a round of applause there for Barry West, the South West Regional Organiser for the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, speaking at the Enough is Enough rally in Bristol this week. And, he's putting it pretty clearly, isn't he, that, I love this point he's making there. He's actually that Labour should have been in power, and they'd have been sorting out all the housing, they'd have been sorting out education, making sure that we didn't have these ridiculous NHS waiting lists either, Martin.
Well, if you actually look at the Labour manifesto at the last election, it addressed all of the things that are causing the problems in a radical way. And that's exactly why the establishment were determined that it was not going to come to power for all kinds of reasons. And the system, of course, is rigged to prevent those radical changes unless there's a huge upheaval. And, it's always been the way that if you want to change society for the better, it's going to be an uphill struggle. It is, because the powers that be are entrenched. They tend to cling on to power because they've got all the resources of power. Yeah. The wealthy classes and the corporations pay for political advertising and all the rest of it. And it's ultimately often to do with money, which is why the trade unions founded the Labour Party in the 19th century or late 19th century, early 20th century, because there was no other, because that was the only way to go. They had to find their own sources of finance from their own members and then the political levy to the Labour Party and so on. Meanwhile, the other side can get any amount of money from the wealthy classes to prevent that, which is why you need to regulate that. And of course, it was regulated in Scandinavia, and the trade unions were in Sweden and Denmark and Finland. They came to power in the 1930s and 1940s, and they did exactly the same sort of things as we did here, but even more so. And it worked. It wasn't inefficient. They've got some world-beating industries. We haven't got those world-beating industries anymore because we are run by financial sharks and landlords. And that's been the dominant
political. But also, I mean, you know, we don't have a trade policy. A lot of that stuff has gone offshore, hasn't it? And this is partly due to the relaxation of exchange controls. It's really about sovereignty, I suppose. It's whether you decide that you want to keep the wealth in your country or whether you want your people and other people to just be able to move money around the world wherever they fancy.
Yeah, but once, you see, in 1981, when we had the Thatcher government here, who managed to massively increase inflation by increasing VAT to take taxes off the wealthy and then crash the economy to bring inflation down. Inflation had actually been brought down by the social contract between the trade unions and the Labour Party. In France, a left-wing government was elected, the Mitterrand government, which had the communists in the government, and they tried to expand the economy, pretty much like Liz Truss is doing now. We're just going to expand the economy, and on the back of that growth, we will then be able to pay our way. But it couldn't work because the franc collapsed. Yeah. And this is the problem. Once you've got floating exchange rates, the Bretton Woods system actually had fixed exchange rates, and these were negotiated by governments with each other. And that was a kind of legacy of World War II, where the governments of all of the world planned things and talked to each other about what governments wanted to happen. Whereas, of course, once you deregulate the financial markets, you've then got all of this dirty money floating around, and anybody who doesn't do what they want, well, they just dump you in the sewage until you see, and there's nothing you can do about that unless you cooperate across countries. And that, of course, was the potential promise of the EU as originally conceived. But, of course, it was the British and the Americans.
I don't think it was ever originally conceived as anything other than a corporatist operation.
No.
Certainly it was sold. It was sold to the public as what you've just said. But the actual origins of the European movement, etc. This was, Martin, you've got to let me finish sometimes. You've just had a good say there that it was the EU was started as a business project, really. And it was the EEC at the time. And it was always run by big business. I mean, if you've seen any of the, for example, companies like Philips writing the policies, not individual governments, and absolutely nobody was elected in the early days. So, I mean, I think it was sold to people as something which could be, more egalitarian across the continent. But actually, what was going on was that the big corporations, in a fascistic fashion, actually, were conning everybody so that they could take them over. Now, I don't know, you don't agree with that, but I don't think that you can say that it was originally conceived as a great egalitarian project. It was sold as that.
No, the original EU or EEC, it was originally the Iron and Steel Agreement between France, Germany and the Low Countries. And they didn't want anybody else in it. What messed it up is that the British and the Americans, even though they weren't in the EU, insisted that Italy had to be included in it, even though Italy's economy was not suitable to be included in the original European.
Well, just look at John Monnet and the European movement. That's what they were doing all along. They were going step by step towards corporate tyranny. They were moving step by step towards a fourth Reich.
EU project, as originally conceived by General de Gaulle and Adenauer, was taken.
He wasn't in on it, was he?
And turned into a free market project. And of course, then it was a free market project. And of course, we shouldn't have extended the EU to all of these East European countries when they weren't ready to join it. Not in terms that would made any economic sense. It was originally conceived quite tightly as an economic project. And of course, the British eventually decided they wanted to join it. And General de Gaulle famously said, no, we don't want you in this because you're too free market. But of course, eventually we wormed our way in. And then the single market was created with Margaret Thatcher pushing for the single market. Strangely enough, her acolytes now want to leave the single market she created because she saw that the single market would acted exactly the way you've said to drive wages down and to deregulate the economy. Now, the EU has ended up as being, basically run by NATO. But of course, there were considerations at the very beginning that we're going to actually create a third force here that isn't going to be the Soviet Union and it isn't going to be the Anglo-Americans. But of course, that's all history. It's long ago. I mean, what we're going to see now is that the EU and Britain are going to be plunged into a depression to save US capital. That's what's going on. And it's not really about Russia at all.
Okay, we're going to go to the break in a minute. Rather than listen to, we've got quite a bit from Piers Corbyn. If you want to hear the whole thing, you have to go later this evening to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I did have a chat to Piers about something that he calls the Terra Carta, which is the World Economic Forum's plan. I mean, this is the sort of bad joke of all of this, is that the EU was seen as by many people as a bastion of the World Economic Forum. And now, of course, Britain has become a bastion of the World Economic Forum with people like Liz Truss and Prince Charles, closely associated with it. So let's have a listen to Piers's take on and his party, I think, is called Let Britain Live. Let the UK live and stop new normal, that sort of thing. But he's got a lot to say about what he sees as a kind of a new world tyranny coming on, and something that the World Economic Forum have got called the Terra Carta.
Where is it all leading? That's the question you're asking, and this is really important. The complete madness going on now about energy crisis is going to be used as a justification for getting a world grip on the problem, which is going to be, first of all, we've got to control all countries in order to make sure they're green, and that means massive spending, and it has to be coordinated on a world scale, which requires a benevolent dictator, and they were even talking about this in LSE 2 days ago, a benevolent dictator who will give all the policies we need and administer all the money we need. And Prince Charles at the last COP conference was talking about exactly that, about somebody has to be in charge of trillions and trillions in order to make every country green compliant.
I think he was talking, Piers, wasn't he, about a military-style operation.
He was. This is new world tyranny, and coming on the back of saving the planet. It's actually destroying human life and democracy on the planet, and along with the jab, it's destroying a lot of human life itself.
Now King Charles has taken over. He's a major figure, isn't he, in the World Economic Forum?
Well, you see, he's got a choice here. We've got our new banner. We've got a little banner saying we want yes to the Magna Carta, and no to the Terra Carta. Now, the Terra Carta is a World Economic Forum charter for things that have to be done, which includes zero carbon. So it's a green agenda to be used to control the world. And Prince Charles, of course, was promoting this some years ago. Now, he didn't write it himself. It's come from the World Economic Forum. But he has to choose, you see. Is he here to defend the independence of the United Kingdom, i.e. as the legal basis of which is really the Magna Carta, or is he here to destroy it and rule by something outside, which is the World Economic Forum Terra Carta? And if he goes along with the Terra Carta, then he should be removed. And we don't want a so-called monarch or a monarch who is so-called defending our sovereignty, when in fact he's giving it away to an external force.
So that's Piers Corbyn. If you want to hear his take on the moon, I mean, he had all sorts of interesting things. I actually called him about that originally, but it's almost impossible not to talk to Piers about all these other things too. What he was saying basically was that you've got a phase lock with the moon and the earth, which is quite intriguing. So that's why we've got a dark side. And this happens only, as we far as we know, on one other planet, which is Pluto, which has got a similar size planet to the moon up in Pluto. And he also told me something I didn't know. And that is that actually Mercury, the nearest planet to the sun, is almost exactly phase locked to the moon as well. But anyway, what do you make of what he's saying there about this Terra Carta, Martin, and this apparent conspiracy, really, as a world government using crises to try and really centralise power right across the Western world? I mean, obviously, the Russians and the Chinese are not into this at all.
Well, I think it's a bit unfair on the Greens to say that this they are using green rhetoric to justify their power grab. That's clear. And the Greens need to think very carefully about whether they want to be associated with that. And in the past, of course, Greens were very critical of what they call greenwash, where the powerful claim to be helping the planet, and in actual fact, they're not. They've just, they're basically bamboozling people. So that's what I would say about that.
There's a kind of gravy train being created now, though, and quite a lot of Greens have jumped on it.
Well, I know that's the problem. Is it's the same with all radical forces, is the temptation to, if you want to change things, you've got to get into the system to change things. But the problem is by getting into the system, you then become part of the system and you may actually discredit the very ideas that made you critical of the system in the first place. The same thing happened to socialist parties in the past, who got gradually watered down their demands to the point where they were just basically managing capitalism and that was good enough. Think about New Labour. They didn't do anything about things like council housing or reforming the City of London or land ownership or anything. They just basically said, we are not the Conservatives and that's good enough. Although they brought in the private finance initiative, which, of course, was what the neoliberals wanted them to do. So you've then got, both sides are being pulled in the same direction, which is a neoliberal direction. And I think there is still green thinking out there, which is not on that wavelength. And we can, we haven't got time to unpick all of that. This stuff about Terra Cartas and Magna Cartas, there's an awful lot of rhetoric involved in this. The Magna Carta has had an influence on the kind of society we live in. It had an influence on the US, the American War of Independence and Revolution. But in actual practical terms, it doesn't mean that much. And the Terra Carta is just a load of nonsense made up by the World Economic Forum to make it sound as if they're interested in those kind of ideas.
They're trying to make it sound as if it's something, Latin and medieval and fascinating.
Yes, that's right. And therefore of value because it's consistent with previous things. But of course it's not. It's just that it's basically marketing. Yeah. That's all it is.
Okay, before the break, final piece before the break. And like I say, you can hear Piers Corbyn at thisweek.org.uk, the full interview with him, which I found quite fascinating about the moon. Looking also, of course, at this whole idea of eclipses and the amazing coincidence. It's just crazy. The idea that 400 times further away we've got a moon than the sun than the moon, and yet both of them are the same size in the sky. It's sort of a signature, really.
Creepy.
Well, it's almost like a kind of signature in the sky.
But it is interesting that they do, in fact, from Earth.
Well, this
eclipse each other because it didn't have to be like that, did it?
No, it certainly didn't.
It just does.
But it is, and I think Pink Floyd made an album about it actually, which we're going to hear in a minute. Before that, one of the most shocking things I've heard for the last few weeks, which is Mark Steyn on GB News. Looking at these horrific vaccine deaths and injuries. It is pretty shocking. This is Nothing to See Here, which is, I think, is about 2-3 weeks ago, maybe, but on the Mark Steyn Show on GB News, which has become almost unmissable. Like I said earlier, if we had wall-to-wall Mark Steyn type programmes, I could retire tomorrow.
Nothing to See Here. On Sunday, mountain biker Rab Wardell won the Scottish Cross Country Championship, the national championship. On Monday, the champ went on BBC Scotland to talk about his victory.
Talk me through it then. How do you contend with three punctures in a race like this and go on to lift the gold medal?
Unfortunately, I'm probably a little bit too well practiced in managing punctures, but to be honest, it was a bit of a disaster, but no, I just have to keep on trucking and keep racing, and I guess still felt confident that I'd be able to catch the leaders and win, so yeah, just give it my best shot.
So a tremendous come-from-behind win on the Sunday. On the Monday, he's on the BBC talking about it, full of life there. Then he goes home and dies. Headline from the Daily Record. Mountain biker Rab Wardell dies just 2 days after winning Scottish Championship. He went into cardiac arrest on Tuesday morning, less than 48 hours after winning a national championship. His poor, devastated girlfriend, Commonwealth Games and Olympics champion, Katie Archibald, tried to revive him, but she was unable to, as she subsequently tweeted, "I still don't understand what's happened. If this is real, why he'd be taken now, so healthy and happy." Rab Wardell was 37, which is no age to die. Nothing to see here in cycling and nothing to see here in rugby from the Huddersfield Daily Examiner. Tributes to Halifax rugby player Ben, who has died suddenly, age 30. Ben from Siddle died suddenly on Monday, leaving his family and friends completely shocked. The 30-year-old dad played competitive rugby for a host of local league and union teams, including Huddersfield Giants and Bradford Bulls. Nothing to see here in rugby, nothing to see here in cycling, nothing to see here in football. From the Daily Mirror, quote, "Tributes have poured in after the sudden death of West Belfast footballer Molly White." Molly White was 20 and a rising star in women's football. Nothing to see here in boxing. Also from the Belfast Telegraph, a young boxer who passed away suddenly had an infectious smile and kind-hearted nature, his West Belfast club said. St Michael's Boxing Club led tributes to 19-year-old Dominic Oscar after his death last Thursday. Nothing to see here in cycling, rugby, football, boxing, 37 years old, 30 years old, 20 years old, 19. Fit, healthy, in the peak of condition, and dead. But nothing to see here. A few months ago, I thought there might be something to see here in all these sportsmen suddenly dying, and I'm being investigated by Ofcom over it, so I certainly wouldn't want to make that mistake again. Nevertheless, as we've reported, in the Canadian province of Alberta, the leading cause of death is not cancer or dementia, but cause unknown. Death from unknown causes. This was how it's, you see the way, it was just 500 in 2019. 2 years later, it's 3,500. Cause unknown is now spreading to other provinces, including my own native sod, Ontario. On Saturday, Rhea Vanort from Hamilton was jet skiing on Lake Ontario with old friends she hadn't seen since the COVID came along. The friends turned away and then looked back and saw Ms. Vanort's body floating in the lake. Also sudden death. She was 32 and a paramedic, which I mention because it means certain things can be inferred. She leaves a six-year-old daughter. Okay, let's move from the case studies to the big picture. Here is a table from a new report. I expect you're wondering who it's by, some crazy far-right QAnon conspiracy theorist? No, it's the U.S. Society of Actuaries. An actuary, for the benefit of you Twitter trolls, is a person who calculates insurance risk. And if you don't do that accurately, you wind up paying out a lot more money than you ever intended to. So let's look at table 5.7 from the Society of Actuaries, showing excess deaths in America broken down by age. Focus on that red bit. We'll come to that in a minute. At the left-hand side of the table from 2020, the spring and summer of COVID, it's not good. You can see excess deaths of 15 and 16%. Thank goodness all those vaccines came along, eh? But then look at the third quarter of 2021. Twice as many dead 35 to 44-year-olds as there should be. And actually almost as lousy numbers for those in their late 20s and early 50s. So look at that, excess mortality for 25 to 54-year-olds, young and middle-aged Americans. Anything going on in the third quarter of 2021? Well, that was actually the peak of vaccine mandates in America, where in a variety of occupations, from paramedics to Manhattan waitresses in diners, you had to get jabbed to keep your job. And oddly enough, that coincides with massive excess mortality among people in the prime of life. But altogether now, correlation is not causation. That's the dispositive line there. Okay, we've seen a similar picture in the European Union. Here's the latest report from Eurostat. They're keeping it simple here. The pale yellow is for countries with the lowest excess deaths. So that's like Hungary, where deaths are actually down 0.3%. Slovakia, deaths are down 1.9%. Bulgaria, 7.9%. So Bulgaria's got the opposite problem from most places. It's got excess life. You'll scan the Bulgar papers in vain for sudden death from cause unknown. Whereas that dark maroon there, those are the worst countries with excess mortality over 15%. Estonia, 16.2%. Spain, 16.7%. Portugal, excess mortality of 23.9%. More dead bodies than usual. Tell you what, just for fun, boys and girls, let's also take a look at vaccination rates in Europe. This is the rundown of countries. So look at that. The least vaccinated country in Europe is Bulgaria. And they also have the least excess mortality. And the most vaccinated country in Europe is Malta, which isn't included in the excess mortality stats. So let's go to the second most vaccinated country in Europe, Portugal. And they have the highest excess mortality in Europe. So the lowest country with the lowest vaccination rate has the lowest excess mortality, and the country with the highest vaccination rate has the highest excess mortality. But altogether now, correlation is not causation.
So that's the wonderful Mark saying there, who also, by the way, does a very good jazz program on GB News. That I think is around about the end of August. I mean, it's pretty shocking, isn't it? You know, it may be that there is far more to this these mRNA vaccines and this COVID jab, Martin, than meets the eye. Obviously, some of these things could have been to do with side effects of it being more difficult for people to get medical treatment, etc. But the correlation he comes up with at the end there is almost, is the most important point in a way, that we're just not seeing these excess deaths in countries which haven't got got very few people vaccinated.
Well, I'm always willing to listen to arguments which are put together in a rational way. And of course, mRNA vaccines are an experimental technology put out by the pharmaceutical companies, who we know are effectively bad actors in all sorts of possible ways. So I don't find it at all surprising that something like that may be happening. But I point out that in China and Russia, they haven't had mRNA vaccines at all. And large parts of the world haven't had any mRNA vaccines.
We've had people writing into the show, Martin, saying the opposite. But the point here is, in a way, he makes the point when he's talking about he's being investigated by Ofcom. There was an enormous effort, quite clearly an enormous effort, took place in 2020 and 21 to shut down programs like ours that were pointing out that potentially vaccines could injure people. I mean, we were chatting about Andrew Wakefield and his work on potential links between autism and the MMR jab. And also we were looking at the profit motive that there is in the pharmaceutical industry to get people sick. And so that the idea is that maybe that these big pharmaceutical industries don't actually really want to cure people. But key to all of this is that I was trying on this program, and you were too, to inform people about what was going on. But there was a whole operation to shut down people like me. And of course, it was successful. We got booted off FM.
Well, there is obviously an attempt to control what people are allowed to see and hear. Goodness me. I mean, it's been going on for a long time and it's intensifying all the time.
It's turning the mass media and the news systems into this pharmaceutical marketing, basically, and advertising, where they're pretending that it's a news bulletin. It's not. It's just putting out adverts for the drug companies.
Well, I'm not necessarily opposed to all of this analysis, although I would point out, if we're going to talk about COVID, the most interesting thing that's happened in the last 2 weeks is that Kirillov, who is the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare, he's a general, has said we are convinced, or we're getting round to convincing ourselves, that the COVID-19 was a bioweapon. And then, of course, the second tap will be filling all these people with mRNA vaccine.
No, also, Martin...
And surveillance capitalism. In actual fact, all the people who died of COVID and all the people who've possibly been dying from vaccine injuries are all actually victims of World War III.
What the Russians have also pointed out, the Russians have also pointed out their raids on these bioweapons labs in Ukraine have proved that they were playing with all sorts of very nasty pathogens in there that they're not allowed to do.
Yes. And therefore, the real story here, from my point of view, is that the whole COVID scam is World War III. The millions that have died, and there's at least 15 million, possibly more, have died of COVID, and if the people are dying of the vaccines as well, they can be added to that toll. These are the innocent victims of Western multinational capitalist evil. But of course, World War III isn't just on one side. One of the reasons why the Russians went into the Ukraine was to capture those biolabs. And when the history books come to be written, that will probably be seen as a very important development. Ron Unz has got a very good article about this on his Unz Review about the whole. And of course, Jeffrey Sachs has started pointing out that it's definitely the case. He's on the board of the Lancet. It's definitely the case that COVID was a modified virus. Now, all of this...
I think he said it's definitely modified, but he's not sure if it was deliberately leaked or not.
Exactly, because in actual fact, he hasn't got proof that it was deliberately released. What I would say that makes me think it was deliberately released is that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States informed the Israeli Defense Forces in November 2019 that a virus was just going to come out of China. That implies foreknowledge, which implies that they did it deliberately.
Sure
that the Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, and we know the Iranian general staff, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have said, we think this was a biological warfare attack. And what amazes me about GB News and all of these people is that they've been told by the Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians that this is biological warfare. But
they're doing a far better job than the BBC. I don't know why you have to see.
No. I'm just pointing out that they're not actually seeing the big picture. The big picture is this is all warfare, all of it.
Well, I don't know about that at all. I think they're basically they are doing what they can, you know. And the BBC and ITV and Channel 4 seem to be doing absolutely nothing about this. But the point here, I suppose, is it comes back round to the Queen's funeral on Monday, is that we are going into an extremely dangerous world. So we'll be back after the break. We'll be looking at the United Nations General Assembly that's been going on, as well as looking particularly at Ukraine, then some documentaries, and finally the accelerationists after the break.
We have come together to commit into the hands of God the soul of his servant Queen Elizabeth. Here in St. George's Chapel, where she so often worshipped, we are bound to call to mind someone whose uncomplicated yet profound Christian faith bore so much fruit. Fruit in a life of unstinting service to the nation, the Commonwealth, and the wider world, but also and especially to be remembered in this place, in kindness, concern, and reassuring care for her family and friends and neighbours. In the midst of our rapidly changing and frequently troubled world, her calm and dignified presence has given us confidence to face the future as she did, with courage and with hope. As with grateful hearts, we reflect on these and all the many other ways in which her long life has been a blessing to us, we pray that God will give us grace to honour her memory by following her example, and that with our sister Elizabeth, at the last, we shall know the joys of life eternal. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. And God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said unto me, It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son.
up. Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough.
Well, a shame they weren't playing that at the Enough is Enough meeting. Kind of perfect for it, really. And also, Martin, it's a wonderful segue into the fascists in Ukraine. But that was the Dean of Windsor, probably going to get his card soon, David Connor, speaking at the Queen's service at St. George's Chapel in Windsor. Then we had Pink Floyd, Brain Damage and Eclipse from 1973. And finally, that was Chumbawamba, Enough is Enough, from 1994. Martin, what do you make of this whole idea of the fascists in Ukraine? Because this does seem as if, you know, looking at, I was quite shocked yesterday hearing the news where the Azov battalion were exchanged, the prisoners, and they were being talked about as the heroes.
Well, I mean, there's been some criticism on in pro-Russian parts of the internet about why these guys are being released rather than being put on trial or whatever. I think that it's a matter for the Russian authorities to decide what they want to do with these people. What's interesting to me is Medvedchuk, if I pronounced it correctly, has been swapped. And he, of course, is the main leader of the opposition in Ukraine. And he has been basically imprisoned by the democratic government of Ukraine because he's regarded as too pro-Russian. So he's been swapped for Ukrainian prisoners, but he's not actually a military combatant at all.
But let's get back to this point about the Nazis, which is what that last song is about. And that is really to do with, are they Nazis? Are they really Nazis? Certainly, if I noticed a picture of Zelensky the other day online with a Ukrainian soldier stood behind him with a Nazi emblem on his jacket.
Yeah, and then that picture was taken down. Well, I mean, I think anybody who's looked into this objectively knows that there is a very powerful neo-Nazi movement in the Ukraine. And it's been, in actual fact, many of the Azov battalion were trained by British military personnel. We paid our taxes to train these people to kill people. And, of course, Zakhachenko, who was the elected prime minister of Donbass, was killed in 2018 by a car bomb. A car bomb probably planted by Ukrainian special SBU working with British special forces. And I think Liz Truss might think about looking very carefully under her car as we go into World War III Phase 2, because it's quite clear that prime ministers are a legitimate target.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how the security services
are actually attacking all the, you know, this referendum started in the Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine, and they've been attacking the officials who are trying to carry out the referendum.
Yeah. Martin, the officials are very good at looking under Liz Truss's car, but they don't really seem to give a damn when the Labour Party is infiltrated and taken over by the Israel lobby, for example.
Well, no, I mean, we know very well what goes on. The fact of the matter is that the Western intelligence services are part of the problem and not part of the solution. But
isn't it? The way, you know, the Five Eyes they talk about, which is the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia and New Zealand. It's actually Six Eyes. And I think we were told this by Alex Thompson, ex-GCHQ guy who's on the UK column from time to time. It's absolutely clear that it's actually really these six countries that are working very closely together, not just the five.
Well, Liz Truss is openly canvassing the idea that she's going to transfer the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to copy the Americans. So, you know, that's overturning, you know, decades of British policy, which was supposedly even handed. And of course, it never was, still isn't. And, we are dealing with a rogue empire in the West, and that includes the Israeli government.
OK, well, let's move straight away to Putin's announcement just before the convening of the UN General Assembly in New York. Putin basically gives us a situation report and he gives the world a situation report. I was listening to this on the radio, I think it was Tuesday, and thinking to myself, well, I want to actually hear what he's saying. All we got was some BBC guy saying, oh, well, he said this, but of course, the referendums that he's talking about will be a sham. Well, I mean, how do they know about a sham referendum before it's even happened? This really annoys me to hear this kind of nonsense spouted as if it's kind of reporting. Of course, it's not. It's like you were saying, Martin, it's marketing. So anyway, let's have a listen now to the situation report from Putin, Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, as he spoke to his nation and the world before the UN General Assembly convened this week.
Citizens of the Kherson and Zaporozhye regions and other areas that have been liberated from the neo-Nazi regime, I'm going to talk about the unnecessary emergency steps to defend the sovereignty, security and territorial integrity of Russia, about the support of the willingness and will of our compatriots to define their own future, and about the aggressive policies of some of the Western elites who want to preserve their global domination. And for that, they try to block any independently developing centers of development, to impose their will on other countries and peoples, to impose their pseudo values. They want to weaken, to divide, and to eventually to destroy our country. They have been saying directly that back in 1991, they managed to divide the Soviet Union, to bring it to its collapse, and now the time of Russia has come, that it should be divided in many warring regions and areas. And they have been having these plans for some time now. They encourage the armed groups of terrorists in Caucasus. They put the NATO military infrastructure close to our borders. They turned total Russophobia into their weapon. For decades, they were cultivating hatred towards Russia, first of all, in Ukraine. They wanted to use it as the anti-Russian springboard, and they turned the Ukrainian people into cannon fodder, and they pushed them to start the war against our country. They started this war back in 2014. They used armed forces against civilians. They organized genocide and terror against the people who refused to recognize the power. That was the result of this coup d'etat. And after today's Kiev regime basically publicly refused to find peaceful solution to the conflict in Donbas. And more than that, they were speaking about their willingness to get their hands on the nuclear weapons. It became obvious that the large-scale offensive in Donbas is inevitable, and not for that, the attack against the Russian Crimea, against Russia, would be just as inevitable. So the preemptive military operation was the only possible solution. Its main goal is to liberate the entire territory of Donbas. It still is its top priority. The Lugansk People's Republic has been almost completely liberated from the neo-Nazis. The fighting in the Donetsk People's Republic is ongoing. For 8 years here, the Kiev occupational regime has created multi-layered defensive infrastructure, and assaulting them directly would have resulted in heavy casualties. That's why our units and units of the Donbas militia are trying to save their personnel and materiel, and step by step they are liberating the territory. They are cleansing cities and towns of neo-Nazis. They are helping those people who were turned into hostages, into human shields by the Kiev regime. As you know, there are professional soldiers participating in the special military operation. They have contracts with the armed forces, but shoulder to shoulder with them, there are volunteer units, people of various ethnicities, professions, age groups. They are true patriots. It was by their heart's call to defend Russia and Donbas.
So that's Vladimir Putin speaking earlier this week about the, well, immediately, Martin, he's talking about this mobilization and the referenda in these areas, which are taking place today, I believe, to see whether they want to join Russia. Obviously, the people in that part of the world, I think, genuinely do, because they are Russian speakers who've been persecuted, many of them, by Kiev and by Zelensky and a previous president, Yanukovych, I think it was.
Poroshenko.
Yeah. There seems to be, certainly the coverage here has been that there is actually quite a backlash in Russia against this. Demonstrations in the streets, a lot of arrests, but the Russian people saying, actually, we'd rather not fight.
Well, there is going to be differences of opinion about this, and there's a substantial liberal opinion in the big cities in Russia, especially educated young people who use the internet, who don't go along with the Russian government's line. But they're not actually politically significant. I opposed the Falklands War, for example, and we demonstrated against it. And those who were opposed to it were quite passionate in our opposition, but we certainly didn't represent the majority. And that's the case in Russia today. If you look at the actual opinion polls, the majority of Russian opinion is that they are prepared to fight for Russian speakers in the Ukraine because they know that these people have been under the cosh. And of course, there is a legitimate position taken by Stop the War in this country, for example, that both sides should cease and desist and that peace talks should commence. Now, I've got some sympathy for that position, but you can see why Russian public opinion in general is not in favour of that, because they know far more than the Western public opinion about what's actually been going on. Don't forget, they speak Russian. They know what they on their TV screens every night are people speaking their language, saying about how they're being attacked and so on and so forth. And if the British, I mean, you know, we went to war with Argentina for 1,000 people who spoke English, most of whom we'd never heard of, and most people had never even heard of the country.
Yeah, so the irony, of course, is
that the Russians feel a bit more passionate about the people who live in the Donbass.
It was largely because of apparently oil fields around there, which now apparently we don't want anyway.
Well, no, we weren't told at the time it was about oil fields. And there is, incidentally, an easy solution to the crisis here, which is in I'm talking now about the South Atlantic, which is you give the oil fields to the Argentinians and we keep the islands and have to carry on spending money to pay for their health care and so on. Because the Argentinians will say, well, we've got millions of people living in Argentina and you having this Falklands means that you claim all the continental shelf, which has got all this oil in. We need that to improve the living standards of our people. We'll do a deal with you. You can keep the Falkland Islands. We want the oil.
Well, suddenly, and it's obvious
thing,
oil,
that's an obvious suddenly, thing we could do if suddenly, we want peace.
Yeah, but suddenly oil is out of favour, apparently. Anyway, let's go on to listen to the second part. And again, I'll put a full version of Putin's speech up, which was translated very kindly by RT, which is you can still get on Rumble. I think maybe just there's only a few hundred people listen to it now. You know, it's been basically, or watch it, it's been really completely pushed to the margins here in the UK. I'm not sure about other parts of the world. But anyway, here is when he starts to get on to the nuclear threats. He's saying, look, what you're doing, and I think he's right about this, Martin, is if you're bringing in these Mars, German Mars, and US Lockheed Martin HIMARS missiles, you can hit right into Russia. What you're doing is you're using NATO weapons, you're using NATO targeting, and you're targeting Russia. You're using a Ukrainian grunt to press a button. And so by doing that, you're really bringing NATO into this war. So let's have a listen to what Putin had to say at the end of his speech during the week, which was also about this mobilization.
Friends. In their aggressive anti-Russian policies, the West has crossed all the lines. We keep hearing threats against our country, against our people. Certain irresponsible politicians from the West, they don't just say about their plans to supply long-range assault weapons to Ukraine, systems that would allow them to strike Crimea and other territories of Russia. And such terrorist attacks, also using the Western weapons, have been already carried out in Belgorod, Kursk regions. They use contemporary systems, aviation, vessels, satellites, strategic UAVs. NATO is performing reconnaissance along the entire south of Russia. In Washington, London, Brussels, they directly push Kyiv to transfer hostilities to our territories. They don't hide it anymore. They that Russia should be destroyed at the battlefield. And then the political, economical, cultural, and all kind of sovereignty should be lifted from the country. Our country should be ransacked. And now they are using nuclear blackmail as well. They're not just promoting Zaporozhye nuclear power station attacks that could lead to the nuclear catastrophe, but some high-level representatives of the leading NATO countries are making statements about the possible use of the nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction against Russia. Those who are making these statements towards Russia, I would like to remind them that our country also has various weapons in its possession, and in certain components, these weapons are more modern than the Western countries have. And if the territorial integrity of our country is threatened, to protect our country and our people, we will absolutely use all the means that we have in our possession. And we are not bluffing. The citizens of Russia can be confident the territorial integrity of our motherland, our independence and freedom will be protected, will be ensured once again by all the means that we have in our possession. And those who try to blackmail us with these weapons, they should know that the wind can change and blow towards them. In our historic tradition, in the destiny of our people, it is to stop those who want to dominate in the world, those who want to enslave our motherland, our country. And now, too, we will do that. That's how it will be. I trust in your support.
Well, interesting that, you know, he's talking there about, you know, the ransacking. They want to ransack Russia. Well, they wanted to ransack Russia in the 1990s. They did very, very well. And Putin and his colleagues managed to snatch the country back from the international oligarchy that were trying to ransack, well, basically sell it off. No, not even sell it off, just buy it up for nothing. And this is almost like the second bite of the cherry now, Martin, that they're coming back for a real fight to get the wealth of Russia now.
Yeah, and I think this is why Western population doesn't really understand Russian public opinion. The 1990s in Russia, I used to go over there, were absolutely horrendous. You know, they'd had the hard times in Russia. It's been a very unfortunate country in lots of ways. You know, Stalin was no cuddly toy. But on the other hand, in modern living memory, the worst time in living memory for Russians was the 1990s when the West was in charge. And that's seared on the brains of the current generation in Russia. So you get all this poo-pooing in the West. Oh, we don't want to do anything nasty to the Russians. It's Putin making stuff up. Nobody in Russia believes that. Nobody believes that for a minute. The death rate went through the roof. The economy collapsed. The place was virtually destroyed. And they rebuilt it from scratch. And they're actually rather proud of having done that. And they're not going to be pushed around. Who can blame?
But are Russians, Martin, are Russians prepared to fight and die for their country?
I think we've all, the Russian army has already demonstrated that. They've taken far more casualties than the British army has taken in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're still fighting. The Syrian Arab army has nearly taken 100,000 casualties, but they're still fighting. If the whole British army turned up to fight in the Ukraine, that's about 70,000 people, they would all be killed because that's how big this battle is. And of course, what's actually happened is instead of negotiating, instead of finding a way to resolve it, the West has doubled down and doubled down and doubled down. And OK, this is what the result is. They're going to have a referendum in the Russian controlled areas. They are probably going to vote to join the Russian Federation. Then any missile that's fired at them becomes an attack on the Russian Federation. And if you look at the Russian constitution, they are then entitled to go to war. And therefore, if they decide to go to war with NATO, they won't give a warning. They've given the warning. And when they strike back, they will strike back without warning.
Actually, you know what? The Russians, Martin, actually did give a warning last Christmas, didn't they? Which was ignored. They said, look, threatening. Martin, can you let me finish? What they said to both to NATO and to the United States specifically, that we want to negotiate a peace here because we are now at the situation where we're so close to war that we're giving you an opportunity. Look, you're advancing closer and closer to us. You're threatening us more and more. If you don't want a war, let's sign a peace deal now. And they didn't even get a reply, did they?
No, they didn't. And then if they do decide NATO is heavily involved in the war in Ukraine. British military personnel are already there on the ground, paid for by our taxes. Ben Wallace, who's our defence secretary, who survived from the Boris administration, he's on the record as saying, I used to be in the Scots Guards and we kicked the Russians' backside in the 1850s in the Crimea, and I'm sure we could do it again. And it's like that mentality is still, you feel like asking the question, Ben, why were we invading the Crimea in the 1850s? And why do you think that the Russians who lived there didn't like that? What planet do you live on? And this is the problem, is that this is a dialogue of the deaf now. What's going to happen, hopefully there will be no nuclear war because the West will not be stupid enough to initiate one. But of course, they are talking in terms of we could use a tactical nuke. There's no such thing as a tactical nuke in Russian doctrine. If you use any kind of nuke, we are going to annihilate you. and we know we'll be annihilated as well. We believe in mutually assured destruction.
Okay, Martin, before we go to the United Nations, which is the next few clips I've got here, I'd like to have a listen to my talk. Oh, I gave an interview last night on Press TV about a lot of this stuff. I mean, really, it's about the Lavrov announcing at the UN, he believes, and he's saying, announcing to the world that the West and NATO has become part of the Ukraine war, that they are considering that NATO is has engaged itself with this war. And obviously, they're threatening now to start attacking NATO, potentially. But anyway, this is what I had to say. About
a win from the Russians is very simple. What they want is they want some security to know that these HIMARS missiles that the West is supplying and the Germans as well as supplying their Mars, their version of this American missile, is not going to be able to hit Russia or Moscow. So that's the danger that the Russians have been spelling out this week. Putin's speech, I saw, nobody I don't think here in Britain has been allowed to see the speech. What we've heard is that we've heard BBC ITV correspondents interpreting the speech, but we've not actually seen what he said. And what he's saying is, if you bring weapons in that can hit Russia, then we will understand that that is NATO, because they're NATO weapons, they're NATO-coordinated weapons, and that is to say targeted, using NATO satellites to target them, then we will potentially use nuclear weapons. I mean, this is where we are now, is that the West seems to be trying to provoke Russia to do something similar. My worry is, of course, that we'll see potentially even a nuclear false flag attack. So that is to say the West blowing up a nuclear weapon and say, hey, the Russians have just fired this, in order to ramp up the tension. Because I honestly think that that's what the West and the United States want, is they want a war to coordinate with the collapse of the financial system here in the West, and they think that they can actually take advantage of that.
So that's me talking last night about this, Martin. Would you agree, or do you finesse that a little bit? Because, I mean, that's certainly what my interpretation of the Russians being saying, well, look, you know, if you're going to start coming into threaten Russia itself, you know, you've got an enormous amount of firepower in all sorts of different directions, then we, you know, we are warning you that we've got nuclear weapons. Please do not do this.
I don't. Russian strategic doctrine is no first use of nuclear weapons. They've made that absolutely clear. It's the West that talks in terms of using mini nukes. Yeah, the Russians never talk like that. If they go to war with NATO, it will be a conventional war. I mean, the obvious thing they could do is just attack all the bases in Britain, for example. They see Britain as particularly hostile. Our aircraft carrier at the moment is immobilized because it's got a broken propeller in the channel, and they could just sink it with all hands on board. And they wouldn't, if they're going to do that, let's not just be symbolic. We might as well hit Salisbury Plain as well. They'd go for military targets and kill as many military as possible.
Well, they could, yeah. But what about this idea of a nuclear false flag? Because the various false flags we've seen in Syria with the chemical weapons, for example, again and again, haven't really worked, have they?
No, but that's because chemical weapons aren't, in fact, particularly dangerous. Nuclear weapons are. What the Russian strategic doctrine has always been is, we are never going to use nuclear weapons first. But if you use them even a little bit, we are going all out.
And well, I'm not so sure about that. I think that seems to be changing. The Russians are saying that we may use nuclear weapons if the integrity and the future of the country is being threatened by you.
What's the strategic doctrine, as I understand it, and it was laid down a few years ago by Putin, it says that if the existence of our state is threatened, for example, you'd invaded us and you were about to overrun Moscow, then maybe we might use nuclear weapons. There's no danger of that whatsoever. I mean, the West is in no position to do that in a conventional sense at all. It's just hopeless.
I mean, what looks as if it may be about to happen is that the Ukrainians and NATO start shelling Russia in the same way as they've been shelling the Donbass for the last 8 years.
Yes, and if the Donbass votes over the weekend to become part of Russia, then there will be shelling Russia straight away. And that's why the Russians have done what they've done. They're basically saying, once these referendums are through, these places are now part of Russia, so your shelling of them is shelling Russia. And we're going to bring the First Guards tank army down from Moscow. We're going to bring all the guys over from the Far East because there's no threat from the Chinese. And we really are going to sort you out. That's what will happen. Conventional warfare, the Russians are masters of it. The Ukrainians are being reduced to terrorist attacks and attacks on people who are trying to organise referendums. If it comes to a straight-on conventional war fight, they are definitely going to lose.
Well,
if,
look, Martin, I think that the Russian
will be defeated.
The Russian doctrine is changing, I think, because Medvedev has said that Russia can defend these new regions with nuclear weapons. Referendums to join Russia will be held in the Donbass, Kherson and Zaporizhia starting today. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said yesterday Russia could use nuclear weapons to protect the territories of Ukraine that it will absorb after the referendums are held. Referendums to join Russia will be held in the Donbass republics of Donetsk and Lugansk and Kherson and Zaporizhia. Referendums will be held and the Donbass republics and other territory will be accepted into Russia, Medvedev wrote on Telegram. But he's also saying that not only mobilization capabilities, but any Russian weapons, including strategic nuclear weapons and weapons based on new principles, could be used for such protection.
Yeah, but all that's doing is extending the Russian nuclear umbrella over the new territories. They never said they're going to use them first. They've just said these areas are now. So, for example, if they wanted to use a tactical nuke on the Donbass military, that would be regarded by the Russians as a nuclear attack, and they would obliterate Britain, United States, and the places where the orders were given. I don't think we're gaining anything by... The Russians have been very clear. They don't want a nuclear war, nor do the Chinese, nor do the sensible people in the West. But the problem with what we've got now is there's no hotline. There used to be a hotline between Khrushchev and Kennedy. They should pick up the phone and say, what's going on here? Oh, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. That's not there anymore. And this is what the Russians have been saying all along. You've got to take these short-range missiles out of Europe. There was a deal that you didn't bring them into Europe and you ripped it up. We've got all sorts of deals that we did with you when we were a communist dictatorship and you've ripped them all up. Now we're a democracy.
Yeah, but I mean, we were in a situation where we could see suddenly on the news one morning, oh, a nuclear weapon has been used against, say, I don't know, Poland, or maybe even against some training group or I don't know what it could be in Western Ukraine somewhere. But that may not even have actually been fired by Russia. This is what I'm saying, Martin.
I get what you're saying, Tony, but I think that would not work. It wouldn't work because the Russians have said that they wouldn't do something like that. And in any case, the only response that the West could make is an all-out nuclear attack on Russia, which would then evoke an all-out nuclear attack on the West.
There is an extent to which a lot of this may be just fear-mongering.
What the real danger is, Tony, is that there is no real distinction between the delivery system for a nuclear weapon and the delivery system for a conventional weapon. So if you start firing missiles into Russia, the Russians have to presume that it might be a nuclear missile.
And also, of course, it could.
At that point, they have to say, if you're firing that at us, you say it's got a conventional warhead on. We don't know that. We think it might have a nuclear warhead on. So we've got to fire back straight away. That's why we tried to have deals where people had intercontinental ballistic missiles, which took half an hour to hit the target, so people can work out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, no one can work out what's happening now, because a lot of this could just simply be fear.
Just like that.
Fear-mongering. Martin, fear-mongering and scaremongering this could be, you know, from the West as well as from... Well, Russia is reacting to the threat to their territory, but, I mean, it could simply be fear-mongering, couldn't it?
It is fear-mongering. As long as the military do not haven't got a complete death wish on both sides, there shouldn't be a nuclear exchange. And I used to think, well, probably what can happen is that they can fight with conventional weapons, but both sides recognise that any nuclear weapon is going to create an irreversible escalation. But the problem is that the delivery systems could be either conventional or nuclear. If you've got both sides whacking missiles into each other, I was just talking there about whacking some Russian missiles into Salisbury Plain.
Yeah, Martin, you just said this. You just said this a minute ago. So yeah, can we go on to the UK at the UN Security Council, a General Assembly, and we'll start with James Cleverly, because he spoke before. He's our new foreign secretary. So let's see how he gets on. He's talking about distortions, dishonesty and disinformation. He's got a quite a nice little phrase of alliteration there to do with what he thinks the Russians are up to. This is James Cleverly, Britain's brand new foreign secretary.
Mr. Putin must understand the world is watching and we will not give up. As members of the Security Council, we must unequivocally reject Russia's attempts to annex Ukrainian territory. We must make clear to President Putin that his attack on the Ukrainian people must stop, that there can be no impunity for those perpetrating atrocities, and that he must withdraw from Ukraine and restore regional and global stability. If he chose to, he could stop this war, a war which has done untold damage to the Ukrainian and the Russian peoples. His war is an assault on Ukraine, an assault on the UN Charter, and an assault on the international norms that protect us all. So, we stand with our Ukrainian friends for as long as it takes, because Ukraine's fight for freedom is the world's fight for freedom. It is our fight for freedom. And if Ukraine's sovereignty and territory are not respected, then no country is truly secure. These are the reasons why Ukraine can and must win. Thank you.
Well, that's the voice of JB Morgan. That's the company he worked for before he came into government. And that's James Cleverly, the Brit, Martin.
Yes, well, it's the usual boilerplate. It's all their fault. They're to blame. They've got to do this. They've got to do that. Nothing we've done. And, well, you know, it's what you'd expect them to say. And, of course, by saying things like that, they make it impossible for a negotiated solution. So there won't be a negotiated solution. The Russians are just going to win outright. And James Cleverly will be long gone. And Putin probably still be there. He says in that Putin could stop this war tomorrow. He couldn't, actually, because the political pressures on Putin to do what he's doing, he's actually been a moderate in the debates within Russia. This is totally missed in the West. If Medvedev was in charge, then they'd already have escalated to full-on fighting with NATO. It's Putin that stopped that. But they're too stupid to understand that. I mean, that are supposed to represent their characters. Well, Cleverly is not really a very good name for somebody like that.
No, it's not. No, but I mean, it's just the City of London speaking. That's the way I see it. And the Pinay Circle, people like that. But he's not, as far as we know, a member of the Pinay Circle. So let's see if our new Prime Minister Liz Truss does any better at the UN General Assembly debate, the 77th session. This week, Liz Truss in New York.
No one is threatening Russia. Yet as we meet here this evening, in Ukraine, barbarous weapons are being used to kill and maim people. Rape is being used as an instrument of war. Families are being torn apart. And this morning, we have seen Putin trying to justify his catastrophic failures. He's doubling down by sending even more reservists to a terrible fate. He's desperately trying to claim the mantle of democracy for a regime without human rights or freedoms. And he's making yet more bogus claims and saber-rattling threats. This will not work. The international alliance is strong, and Ukraine is strong. The contrast between Russia's conduct and Ukraine's brave, dignified First Lady, Elena Zelenska, who's here at the UN today, could not be more stark. The Ukrainians aren't just defending their own country. They're defending our values and the security of the whole world. That's why we must act. That's why the UK will spend 3% of GDP on defence by 2030, maintaining our position as the leading security actor in Europe. And that's why, at this crucial moment in the conflict, I pledge that we will sustain or increase our military support to Ukraine for as long as it takes. New UK weapons are arriving in Ukraine as I speak, including more MRLS rockets. We will not rest until Ukraine prevails. In all of these areas, on all of the fronts, the time to act is now. This is a decisive moment in our history, in the history of this organisation, and in the history of freedom. The story of 2022 could have been that of an authoritarian state rolling its tanks over the border of a peaceful neighbour and subjugating its people. Instead, it's a story of freedom fighting back. In the face of rising aggression, we've shown that we have the power to act and the resolve to see it through. But this can't be a one-off. This must be a new era where we commit to ourselves, to our citizens, and this institution that we will do whatever it takes to deliver for our people and defend our values. As we mourn our late Queen and remember her call to this Assembly, we must devote ourselves to this task. Britain's commitment to this is total. We will be a dynamic, reliable, and trustworthy partner. Together with our friends and allies around the world, we will continue to champion freedom, sovereignty, and democracy. And together, we can define this new era as one of hope and progress. Thank you.
On behalf of the Assembly, I wish to thank the Prime Minister and First Lord of the Treasury of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland for the statement just made. And
And also, of course, suicide as well, because she seems to think that she can take on Russia and win, Martin. Effectively, going through a whole list of things there, just kind of gaslighting the Russians, really, saying also that the Ukrainian army are there defending our values. Well, our values are making sure that any kind of left-wing opposition in this country is infiltrated, closed down, and the people like Jeremy Corbyn have the election stolen from under their nose.
It's not just that. Don't forget, we invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and we supported the jihadis in Syria to try and overtake that country. And we've been involved in all of that. It's probably British special forces who are behind the assassination of Zakhachenko, as I said earlier, the elected prime minister of Donbass region. And that is our terrorist pledge. And of course, the Russians, this kind of rhetoric is pushing the Russian public opinion, not Putin, Russian public opinion, to the conclusion there's no point talking to these people. The only thing the British understand is dead soldiers. And we need to send some dead soldiers back to Britain. And of course, if we're really going to take the gloves off, we're going to go after your prime minister, just like you went after Zakhachenko. Yeah, because there's no rules. You're telling us there's no rules. It's interesting that she goes about the UN doing this, the UN doing that. We invaded Iraq without UN authorization. We invaded Yugoslavia without UN authorization. We invaded Libya without UN authorization. There was UN authorization what happened in Afghanistan because the Russians and the Chinese said OK then on that occasion. But they're not going to say OK then going forward. And it looks, if you look at the number of countries which are supporting sanctions on Russia, it's just Western and Eastern Europe. India, our old colony, is not going to put sanctions on Russia. Nobody in Latin America is going to put sanctions on Russia to help the Americans that have been oppressing their people for 200 years. Nobody in Africa is going to put sanctions on Russia. We didn't quote from Cyril Ramaphosa there, who was from the South Africa. He spoke outside the Assembly saying, you are trying to make us that we can't buy stuff from Russia. That is actually making our lives a misery because we buy lots of stuff from Russia and we're not going to be bullied. Now, this is totally missing from this self-referential, narcissistic Western it's not even dialogue, it's just talk. It's just talking to ourselves.
Yeah, it's one-way talk, isn't it? This is exactly what Lavrov said it was like when Liz Truss visited Russia. I think it was around about February or just before the special military operation or invasion. He said it was just like talking to someone that couldn't hear anything. And she's the kind of person, I'm afraid, what you do is you just wave your hand in front of her face and she's still completely unblinking. She hasn't even seen you. Mind you, I mean, one of the main things that they're talking about, of course, as ever at the UN is the Middle East, with Iranian protests now, amazingly at the same time as the UN General Assembly. It's a bit embarrassing for Iran. Protests taking off, we hear yesterday on Fox News, Martin, in 100 cities, 30 provinces, with dozens of arrests.
Well, obviously, it's hard to assess exactly what's going on.
What's happened is Mahsa Amini, who was arrested by the morality police, apparently died in custody.
Well, Chris Cabba was shot dead by the police in Britain, but we haven't gone out and burned the place down yet. Maybe we should have done in 2011 when Mark Duggan was shot. Kids did go out and burn the place down. But was that a justifiable reaction? I don't know. What the Raisi, the president of Iran, is saying, whatever the police did there should be investigated. That's what the police, the Metropolitan Police here, are saying about the murder of Chris Cabba. But of course, we're not hearing the British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly calling for riots in Britain to undermine, because it's, if people die in police custody, that's clearly evidence that the regime's corrupt and it's time to be overthrown, isn't it?
OK, well, we're going to hear from the Iranian president, Saeed Ibrahim Raisi, in a minute. But first, let's go to the new Israeli president, Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who was addressing the United Nations debate yesterday.
In this building, we've been asked more than once why we do not lift the restrictions on Gaza. We are ready to do that tomorrow morning. We are ready to do more than that. I say from here to the people of Gaza, we are ready to help you build a better life, build an economy. We presented a comprehensive plan to help rebuild Gaza. We only have one condition. Stop firing rockets and missiles at our children. Put down your weapons. There will be no restrictions. Put down your weapons. Bring home our children who are being held in captivity. Hadar and Doron, may their memory be a blessing. Avera and Isham, who are still alive. And we will build your economy together. We can build your future together, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. Put down your weapons and prove that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are not going to take over the Palestinian state you want to create. Put down your weapons and there will be peace. That is the minimum I owe my grandfather, my father, and my daughter. The Jewish people have learned the lessons of the past. Our security is guaranteed by our military might, our economic ingenuity, our democratic resilience. Israel seeks peace with all our neighbors, all our neighbors. We are not going anywhere. The Middle East is our home. We are here to stay forever. And we call upon every Muslim country from Saudi Arabia to Indonesia to recognize that and to come talk to us. Our hand is outstretched for peace.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid there speaking. Martin, he's saying that they're going to lift restrictions on Gaza tomorrow morning if the Palestinians lay down their weapons.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians should just lay down their weapons, shouldn't they? And then there could be peace. But apparently not. They've got to fight to the end to get every inch of territory back. Yeah, there's no negotiations possible. But of course, in the Israeli case, totally the opposite. Incidentally, he also said that Hamas cannot be the government of an independent Palestinian state, despite the fact that that's what people voted for. Now, the Israelis could have peace if they put down their weapons, but they're not going to, are they? That's not what happens in the real world. Sometimes people do put down their weapons, as the Irish Republican movement did. It caused a lot of grief. It was quite difficult to do, but they did it. But that was required both sides to negotiate. There's no negotiation with the Israelis. There's no negotiation with the Ukrainians. There's no negotiations with Liz Truss. They don't negotiate. In that case, it's war then, isn't it? And war is horrible. It's horrible in the Ukraine. It's horrible in Gaza. It's horrible in Libya. It's horrible in Iraq. It's horrible in Afghanistan. Incidentally, the former prime minister of this country, Gordon Brown, to his credit, has called for the seizure of Afghanistan's assets by the West to be overthrown, and for the new government there to be given the resources to prevent a famine in Afghanistan over the winter. But of course, that's not going to happen. James Cleverly isn't going to agree to it. The Americans aren't going to agree to it. So possibly millions of Afghans will die of starvation over the start of the winter. And of course, that won't really be penetrating people's consciousness, because we'll be too worried about the poor old Ukrainians. And isn't it? It's just the hypocrisy of it all is quite obvious to people in the developing world. In Africa, I've been reading loads of stuff from all the leaders in Africa saying that we are not interested in having a war or an economic war with Russia to keep you happy. We're not going to do it. And that's because they know who the enemy is, and it ain't the Russians. The president of Senegal said, we're not going to have any kind of arguments with the Russians because they've never done anything to us. On the other hand, France, our colonial power, you have done stuff to us and you're still doing it. And this is what's going to happen. The Russian-Chinese bloc is going to rally the rest of the world. In Latin America, the left have just won in Colombia. In Mexico, they're calling for a ceasefire in the Ukraine. It's the West versus the rest. And, of course, we ain't going to win, and we don't deserve to.
Well, again, in New York at the United Nations, we had the Iranian president, Saeed Ebrahim Raisi, addressing the general debate. That is the 77th session of the UN General Assembly, also yesterday, in contrast with the Israelis. But anyway, let's have a listen to him now, Saeed Ebrahim Raisi, the president of Iran.
If we wish the new world to be acceptable, to be one of character, to be one that is powerful and successful in resolving challenges facing humanity, has no solution other than to be based on international fairness and justice, which needs the following principles. One, feeling collectively responsible throughout the world against oppression. Number two, respect for the wish and will of the people and nations, and refraining from direct engagement in their internal affairs. Three, elimination of double standards. Four, standing up against violence and war. Five, independence and prudence in the actions of international organizations. And most importantly, the creation of roles for dignified and qualified humans of experience so they can create this new system. Our viewpoint towards the horizon of the future is very realistic, and we firmly believe that based on divine promises as delivered by the prophets, justice will take over the world. And those who are true followers of divine commands will be blessed by the reappearance of the last Messiah. I thank you all sincerely for your kind attention. May the blessings of the Omnipotent be on you.
Well, that was quite an interesting way to finish the speech there, really, talking about, divine prophecy, justice will win, Martin, and also the last Messiah is coming back.
Yeah, and of course that'll be picked up in the West. Oh, loony people believing all this.
Well, I don't actually think it's been picked up hardly at all.
Well, no, exactly. The other thing is they just ignore it, don't they?
It's actually interesting that, you know, the way that this whole idea of, divine spiritual justice is growing out there.
Well, I mean, some people have always believed in that, whatever, various religious beliefs. It's not really that exceptional, is it? Let's face it. Let's just remind people that the Americans assassinated the top Iranian general, General Soleimani. If the Iranians had assassinated, I don't know, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was involved in the running the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland, that would be regarded as an act of terrorism. If the IRA had assassinated him, it would have been regarded as an act of terrorism. That the assassination of Soleimani was probably one of the most reckless acts since the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in 1914. And that was carried out by a lone nutter working with the Serbian intelligence services, undoubtedly, but definitely a minor actor compared to the US military. And they do stuff like that, and then they turn around and say, yeah, but we just want peace. Soleimani was on his way to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Saudis about what they could do to, finesse things and perhaps come to some arrangement. And that's when he was assassinated, precisely when he was on that peace mission. And he presumed he was going to be all right because that's what he was doing. And that just shows you what they really want. They want a third world war so that they can dominate the planet. The new American century and all the rest of it. The Israelis want to dominate their local neighbourhood.
Well, they may not succeed. And Putin was saying, he said that the wind may blow in against them in their direction.
Well, we're going to see. The Iran was at Samarkand because they're now a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And they are a firm alliance is being formed between China, Russia and Iran. And that is going to be a game changer. Countries like Britain that used to have a fleet that went around the world, forcing opium on the Chinese and taking over in India and all the rest of it. That is history. Our aircraft carrier is currently immobilized in the channel because it was on its way to the US, but its propeller broke. And I presume all the sailors are still on it.
Well, I wouldn't presume that. Anyway, that was President.
Oh, there's nothing else to do with it.
That was President Saeed Ebrahim Raisi of Iran. That's the last of. I mean, there are all sorts. Obviously, the Chinese will be interesting to see what they had to say too. But you can't do it all. I don't think there's much point in listening to what Biden had to say because it's pretty obvious. But anyway, we don't want to be here all night. And so I think what we'll do is probably skip over the genetic entropy piece tonight and have a listen to one of these documentaries, which is called The Last Battle. It's actually quite an old one from 2017. But these things, I've given up moaning about the rubbish documentaries on our television, even though I was probably a bit earlier on with the Al Jazeera one being so much better than anything that's being produced on any of the major networks in Britain anymore. This one is called Europa, The Last Battle. And this is just the opening sequence of it. And the speaker is a guy who some of you will know called Ken O'Keefe.
It is very clear that the head of the snake is the financial system. The whole point of finance is to indebt, otherwise to enslave. What is a mortgage? I mean, what does that stand for? It's a death grip. So when you get a mortgage, you have a death grip held over you because you are in debt. You don't even own the house. The bank owns the house that loans you the money to buy the house, unless you're fortunate enough to have all the money to buy it outright. And even then, you can be taxed by the government. And if you fail to keep up with those taxes, the government can then take it from you. The whole system is based on a financial fraud, which effectively takes the power that we have and it gives it to a tiny group of individuals who are running the world through the control of finance. With the infinite supply of money that we have allowed them to take, they have literally an infinite supply of money, and with that money, and from their psychopathic point of view, they have bought everything and everyone who can be bought. So those of us who cannot be bought, because we operate on a level that goes way beyond the material, we are not rewarded for such behavior, we are punished for such behavior. And the most slovenly, disgustingly criminal, pedophilia, corrupt moral individuals, those are the ones that are rewarded in this system, which is upside down. We reward the pedophiles, we reward the corrupt, we reward the liars, we reward the people with no morals at all.
Yes, we reward the people with no morals at all. So that's Ken O'Keefe. He's a former US Marine, I think, Martin, but he's spelling it out in just a few words there. Money is kind of at the centre of this scam, and he's quite right, isn't he, that the oligarchy is centred around the money power.
It is, and obviously that's a very, succinct summary of what's going on, but the financial system in the West is the source of all of this, and it always has been, but it's now metastasized since 2008. It's become absolutely dominant in the Western power structure. But of course, all actions provoke a reaction, and you're now seeing peer competitors emerging. which is what the Chinese certainly represent that. And that, of course, is the explanation probably for the biological warfare attack on the back of all the other things we've done. Or not we, you and me, our leaders have done.
Okay, well, anyway, that's...
The rest of the world is rising up.
Yeah, the that documentary is called Europa, The Last Battle. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But that, in a way, is a bit of an introduction to something which is much more up to date. And it's not a documentary. It's just a film of a conference that took place, I think, last week, 10th of September, anyway. And it's called The Liberation from Deception Conference in Holland. And so then our next speaker is one of my favourites in the world. She's Catherine Austin Fitz. And here she is talking about the Central Bankers Central Bank, the Bank for International Settlements. And she's got here some clips from some of their people explaining what they're up to. So here's Catherine Austin Fitz speaking at the Liberation for Deception conference the other day in Holland.
What I want to do today is look behind the walls of secrecy at some of the privileges that we're dealing with, because behind our sovereign governments, 190 plus sovereign governments around the world, there is a power that is not playing by the same rules we are. And we're recognizing their privileges, we're affording their privileges, and this is something we need to deal with. So I want to talk a little bit about the secret sauce behind central banks, the use of sovereign immunities, and secrecy to engineer a global coup. Since the mid-90s, we've been in a serious financial coup around the world, and we're all feeling the pain of it. So let's just dive in. Everybody know who I mean by the Bank of International Settlements? Okay, the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of the central banks, and we're going to talk a little bit about who they are and what they do. First, first, I want to give you a sense of where they're going with their sovereign immunities and powers of secrecy and other things. To play the video I just punched, okay? 56 seconds, best explanation I've ever seen of what's coming or what they're going to try and do. But here's the other thing. This 56 seconds is something I swore I would never see in my life, and that is a central banker being honest. This is a miraculous experience. 56 seconds. Here we go.
Our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash, and there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
Okay, so that was Augustine Karstens, the general manager of the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, Switzerland. And what he said is, with digital currencies, they will have the ability to set the rules and to enforce those rules centrally, which means if they don't want your money working more than 5 miles from your home, it won't work more than 5 miles from your home. It means if they decide to raise the taxes, they just take it from your account. Okay, so they set the rules, they see everything, and they can enforce centrally. Now, I'm going to show another video. This is Richard Werner, arguably the top academic scholar in the world on central banking, in Malmo, Sweden, this May, describing his conversation with a European central banker. It's about 2.5 minutes. Let's dive in.
It's possible that even if you have to have CBDC in some form, that you're not destroying the banking system. If you do the way China is doing it, now you have to remember, China only recently introduced their banking system, and it seems they were not willing to already give it up. They have already CBDC. It's still a pilot project, but it's introduced, you know, among millions of people already. But it was introduced on purpose in such a way that it would not harm the banking system, and therefore is a more truthful sort of update of the old paper money. But of course, it still has the control aspects. So at least it's not killing the banking system. The way they do this is by requiring you to have a bank account in order to get CBDC. So it's not a direct account at the central bank. It's only through your bank that you can get it. You see how simple that is? And of course, could be done over here, but they're not discussing it. Say, the ECB is not discussing it because you see their agenda is to get rid of banks. But this alternative exists. But then, of course, the key problem is this control aspect, which at the moment they haven't stepped up in China, but that can be introduced any time. And that, of course, is a concern. Also, they never talk about the nature of this CBDC. What is it actually going to look like? They never talk about that. But I heard one European central banker tell me what it's going to look like. He saw it. He was invited to one of the old central banks in Europe that are very much promoting this, and they showed him, and you know, he's a top executive director of another central bank in Europe, and there's no reason to believe that he was telling me a story, and it was around this large and would be implanted under your skin. So that is the plan,
right?
And of course that has other implications on top of what we've mentioned, on top of the control aspects, because that actually enters your body, in my view, violates human dignity, and can be then used for even in terms of functionality beyond the monetary and economic transaction purposes. So highly dangerous, and definitely something we have to oppose. And so using cash is one of the things we can do to make sure that it will be, the hurdle will be higher for the central planners to introduce the CBDC.
Lest you think that that's something far, far away, I just got an email from a subscriber in Australia who sent a video that included a review of a mailing that one of the large financial institutions in Australia had just sent to one of their customers, suggesting that they consider putting a chip in their hand in Australia, in a Commonwealth country. That's extraordinary. Okay, so let's go back to the BIS. Who is the BIS? The BIS has, just let me go through key facts and figures. The BIS has sovereign immunity, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that sovereign immunity has evolved over the years and is now being used in extraordinary ways. It is governed by a self-perpetuating board. It has a group of shareholders who are its members, 63 monetary authorities and central banks around the world. So not every central bank is a member and shareholder of the BIS. It's still predominantly the Western world. Russia just got put on probation as a result of what's going on with the sanctions. So we have a self-perpetuating board, and now its powers are being extended by what's called innovation hubs that they're placing around the world, which are negotiating treaties that give them sovereign immunity in these different places to help auger in and bring in the CBDC. Under the equivalent of their charter, what they can do is they can transact gold, they can maintain deposits, securities account data and financial assets for their 63 members, as well as for, you ready for this? Other. Who's other? This is one of the unanswered questions in the global economy. But if you look at their balance sheet, they stipulate that they can create and maintain investment vehicles which are off balance sheet. So you have secret pots of money, and you have a global financial piping system that can go anywhere, do anything within that group of 63 members and other, completely behind secrecy. They have the right to encrypt and keep all of their data and documents secret.
Catherine Austin Fitz there at the Liberation Fraud Deception Conference last week, the other week, recently anyway. So just to go through some of the jargon there, for anyone that might not be familiar with it, the CBDC is the central bank digital currencies. We had Nick Corbishley, who's done a brilliant book about that, on a couple of months ago, talking about the central bank digital currencies, what they are, what they mean. And then the BIS is the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank. Yeah, so this idea of having these kind of, what she talks about there at the end as other, this sounds to me like a kind of secret slush fund with which the central bankers can actually do anything they want with an almost infinite amount of money, with nobody being able to track or trace them anywhere.
Well, the history of the Bank of International Settlements is it was set up at the end of the First World War to supervise reparations payments by the Germans to the Western powers, and that's where it started to get its...
Yeah, the Treaty of Versailles, yeah.
Yeah, and also... you know, Montagu Norman, who was the British head of the Bank of England, was obviously a member of the BIS. And he, for example, handed over Czechoslovakia's assets to the Germans when they invaded Czechoslovakia on the basis that wars come and go, but central banks go on forever. And we've got to, you know, the central bankers stand above even world wars, although that's just been ripped up because 300 billion of Russia's assets have just been seized by the Western powers, defying all of that. You know, in other words, the idea that is just wrong. The BIS, as she's just pointed out, represents the Western powers. And I'd like to see them go into the Donbass now and start putting chips on people because they're likely to get their head blown off. And they probably get their head blown off in a favela in Brazil or in a barrio in Colombia.
Yes, this isn't necessarily going to go down very well, is it?
No, it's not. So this kind of, you know, controlled life that the people fear with chips and you know, everything's going to be controlled by electronics and so on, is really a fear for the relatively privileged. The very poor don't have bank accounts.
Well, it all depends, I suppose, if, you know, someone said, Martin, I mean, you know, it depends. If for example... The only way you can get some food for your kids or for yourself or some fuel to get to work is by having one of these things. People will do it, won't they?
They will. But in actual fact, people are so poor, who are the poorest people, that the chip will be worth more than they are. And there's no, you know, they may use things like that as a kind of control when they're carrying out insurgency operations and so on and so forth. But the Taliban have just demonstrated, you know, we don't use mobile phones because there's no phone masts in Afghanistan.
Well, I know, but I mean, shortly, what's going on here? I mean, we've just been talking about the economic collapse, actually, with the pound sliding as we speak.
Yeah.
And also the war in Ukraine potentially spreading. All these kinds of things going on. It seems pretty obvious to me that what's being planned is a conflagration of some sort, you know, like along the shock doctrine Naomi Klein point of view. So you shock everybody with an economic and a military doodah, and then you say, it's okay, well, we found a way to just make sure that everyone can get something to eat. But, you know, always to be fair, you've got to have this microchip to make sure you don't take more than your fair share.
Well, I can see that there are people thinking like that, but whether they're going to succeed is another matter altogether.
It certainly is, yeah.
Because it's what Clausewitz in On War called friction. Yeah, all warfare is friction. And when you've got a plan to do A, B, followed by C, but in actual fact, it never works because there's all these things happen.
Well,
you know,
it's just like, will go wrong. Yeah, it's like General Wesley Clark and his 7 countries in 5 years. That didn't quite work out, did it? Anyway, look, we're going to go on to a final piece now. And we'll say goodbye to you, Martin. But this one is just... So thanks very much for being with us for the last 3 hours. And this is just from a few weeks ago, the interview that I did with David Livingstone, because I asked him about this character, Nick Land, who's a Nietzschean philosopher. He was one of the top philosophers at Warwick University for a long time. And then he went over to China. But he's apparently one of those people who wants to start a third world war. He's quite into the whole idea of philosophy. Of that, in you know, Nietzsche, and he's into this whole idea of man and Superman, and man can become God, this kind of thing. and also into technology, very much into the sort of technocracy and into the whole transhumanism. Anyway, it was just bizarre that I was interviewing David a year or so ago, and he came up with his name. I thought, crikey, I know this guy. Our school was right next door to something called the Wellcome Trust, which is the British equivalent of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, just an ordinary old grammar school in Beckenham in Kent, Langley Park it's called. And, you know, I got to know Nick very well over 2 years. And he was known at the time as Nick the Nazi. But the weird thing was when we turned 16, 17, we both went into the sixth form. He then became a communist, like over the summer holidays. I hadn't seen him over the holidays, but when he turned up at school again, he was no longer a fascist, but a communist. Anyway, Nick is an interesting guy, and here is David Livingston talking a bit about him and his accelerationist movement. And I'll put a link up to the excellent Guardian article about the accelerationists on thisweek.org.uk tonight.
It's called accelerationism, and Nick Land is effectively known for spearheading it. Popular in most of the modern neo-Nazi circles. Nick Land also praised the work of the Order of Nine Angles. And one of the representatives of the order is Kerry Bolton, who is also associated with Dugin. And though Dugin, of course, has inspired most of the founding, a lot of these modern neo-Nazi satanic orders, and another proponent, maybe not so much Nick Land, basically is known for also having coined the Dark Enlightenment, and that is a philosophy that has, I mean, first of all, acceleration, it goes all the way back to the Process Church, right? And that's what's important. So the Process Church inspired Charles Manson, and it's really the order that links so many people, because it links also back to, this is what I talk about in my chapter, I think it's Six Lies and Videotapes, Wiretaps, that links to Roy Cohn, because the Son of Sam used to attend parties that were hosted by Roy Cohn. So basically parties of a satanic nature. And Roy Cohn was Donald Trump's mentor. And Roy Cohn is really, in the United States, he's the key leading figure that connects to the Fascist International. He's the one who introduced Rupert Murdoch to Ronald Reagan and basically effectively began his career. And of course, Fox News is the organization which is largely responsible for the partisan divide that is currently dividing the United States, and the entire push for, you know, this smutty right-wing media, which is creating or feeding the dialectic in the United States. It connects, those Process Church also connects to, of course, the Rosemary's Baby and that entire network that were connected to the Manson killings. It connects to Robert Evans, who was the producer of Rosemary's Baby, and he's a guy who is really at the top of the pyramid of that entire network involved in the Me Too movement, which I talk about in that chapter. So it's basically a very significant movement. We can't underestimate its importance. And again, the idea of accelerationism is the idea that they're trying to accelerate the coming of the end times. We have to remember that, we tend to think of satanic organizations as being almost anti-Bible, but they're not really. They are Gnostics, so they believe in the reverse of the Bible. So like Dan Brown would say, by quoting William Blake, where you see white, they see black. So where we see the coming as the Antichrist and wars and famine and destruction as being negatives, they see all those things as positives. So they believe in the necessity of creating the preconditions of the end times, creating the chaos, creating the destruction through acts of terrorism, through acts of violence, as a way in their minds of preparing the arrival of the Messiah. So again, this leads all the way back to Nick Land also coining the so-called Dark Enlightenment, which is a very dark fascist philosophy, which is inspired Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel is a Bilderberger, a founder of Palantir, and he is really, you know, one of the leading, he's at the forefront of, you know, in many ways of the transhumanist movement of the, and Palantir was the organization which assisted Cambridge Analytica in breaching Facebook data, which was then used by the Russians in their campaign orchestrated by Dugin to have Trump elected.
David Livingston there talking about my old school chum, Nick the Nazi, Nick Land. And interesting to hear him talking there about this being a satanic group, because I was just chatting with someone a couple of weeks ago who was with Nick at Warwick University when he was in the philosophy lecturer there, saying that, oh, Nick was conjuring demons, so, or trying to, and so that doesn't come as much of a surprise. Anyway, very interesting. I think it's important to study people like these accelerationists and to see what their influence is these days, because it doesn't seem to be all that complicated to actually get these various fake versions of the faith, like the Zionists and the Christian Zionists, to have a war. We had it in the English Civil War, didn't we, with the Puritans, who were totally unchristian, even though they went under the guise of Christianity, and to have this war. Interesting also that we've been hearing from the Iranian president about the return of the Messiah. We heard the similar stuff there. And also the whole idea of philosophy, really, of philosophy departments nurturing this kind of thing, very concerning. And accelerationism, well worth getting your head around who they are. The idea, one of the, I think it's, I'm not sure if it's that Guardian article, but one of the articles I was reading was saying, well, they're not just atheists. They hate Christians particularly and Christianity, and that's their big bugbear. The idea really is to get Christianity to rub its nose in the dirt, kind of thing, rather than just allowing them to carry on and people like me to carry on with our beliefs. To rub your nose in the dirt and say, well, if you can start a big world war, where's your God now, mate? Where's your God now? And that's their one of their big driving forces. They get a kick out of that. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And please download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. We've got Piers Corbyn. We've also got Kevin Cahill and others. Longer interviews with them tonight, which I'll upload later. And do please send me interviews and story tips, etc. We'll do some more of those documentaries as well next week. I think I'm starting to get more interested in the idea of, well, let's just point out some of the good stuff rather than an interesting. I'm not saying I agree with it all, but it's certainly well worth watching. Much better than the bland nonsense that there is, you know, on the modern TV. It's absolutely appalling. And so anyway, this week, oneword.org.uk is our website. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, which is talkradio.org.uk. And also Sunday lunch at Radio Camberley's, CamberleysRadioQUK.com. So, censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today. That is to say, in the empire of lies. Thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses. But do try and tune in to Mark Stain. He's doing a fantastic job. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us or help get the word out, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM, not BCFM weekend. And join us at 5 o'clock next Friday, if you can, at talkradio.org.uk, live for this, the not the BCFM politics show. Download our app if you've got an Apple on the Apple Store, Apple App Store. God bless. And don't let Basel's Illuminati banksters get you down.
When the moon goes between the sun and the earth, we have a solar eclipse. When the earth goes between the sun and the moon, we have a lunar eclipse. So those are the two types. The lunar eclipse is what you see is the, you first of all see the moon going sort of darker and then getting completely covered. Because there's an umbra and a penumbra, a shadow and a partial shadow, you see. When you see the moon crossing the sun's disk in the solar eclipse, you see, first of all, a partial eclipse and a bit of the sun is bitten out. And then if it's lined up correctly, then you'll see a total eclipse. There is quite a lot of partial eclipses, of course, where it doesn't happen exactly right. And those are called partial eclipses. So they're all tabulated and calculated.
Yeah, so you have to go get on a plane and go to a different part of the world to see it properly.
You do. And then you need a long-range weather forecast from me to know whether it's going to be sunny or not.
I suppose it's a kind of thing of geometry, really, that the idea that the sun can be so, 400 times further away, and yet we now know that. Of course, the ancients didn't. And in a way, we've seemed to have forgotten these incredible phenomena today.
We have. Yes. Now, there isn't an explanation as to why it is that size. There might be an explanation in terms of the solar wind. I don't know. But you see, it's just a marvel. That's all I can say. It's a marvel.
Well, I think we just have to say it's an incredible coincidence. And some would say it's evidence for intelligent design.
Yes, of course. It is an argument for intelligent design, yes. But there's something else which could also be an argument for intelligent design, but we have an explanation for it. And this is really quite amazing, and it isn't something that's well publicised. Namely, that I mentioned the nodal crossings, right? So the moon crosses the orbit of the Earth twice in its orbit. It goes below it and then goes round again and comes above it. And the period from crossing, going down, and then up and then down again, for example, is 27.21 days. Okay? And that is, closely measured. Now, another thing that happens, when you look at the sun and you watch spots on the sun, they come round at the latitude where they're most common, when you look at them, they come round and come round again with a period of 27.2 days, namely the same. And that is absolutely incredible. And there's
so
only one other
thing, that's the speed at which the sun is rotating is the same speed at which the moon is tilting backwards and forwards in its orbit.
Yes, that is. It's exactly the same. But that's when you view it from Earth. If you view it from another planet, which goes at a different speed around the sun, because the sun is spinning, then you're going to see a different relative speed. Now, they are the same. That is incredible. Now, there's one other planet-lunar pair where something of this nature happens, namely Pluto and the moon Charon. And the ratio there of the observed spin of the sun from Pluto to the crossing of Charon, the period of that, is 4.0. So it's a whole number. Instead of being one in the case of the Earth, it's exactly four. And all the other planets going around, moons going around planets, there's no special relationship at all. Now, these two things, the Charon and Pluto as one pair, and the moon and the Earth as another pair, are very interesting things in that they're both comparable sized bodies, i.e. the moon is very large, compared with the Earth, compared with, say, the moons of Jupiter, which are looking like specks of dust around a mountain, and Charon and Pluto are, the ratios are even bigger than for the Earth.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor.
And every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, and if there is no moon upon the hill, and if your head explodes with dark foreboding too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon. Is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade, you make the change, you rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door, throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me. And if the cloud bursts thunder in your ear, you shout and no one seems to hear. And if the band you're in starts playing different tunes, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon.
To give,
something to give.
All now
get behind the sun and cast his way. All I need is a place to find, and there I'll celebrate. All in all, there's something to give.
And then the Lord Chamberlain, to mark the end of the reign, will break his staff of office and place it on the coffin.
Like as a father pitieth his own children, even so is the Lord merciful unto them that fear him. For he knoweth whereof we are made, he remembereth that we are but dust. The days of man are but as grass, for he flourisheth as a flower of the field. For as soon as the wind goeth over it, it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more. But the merciful goodness of the Lord endureth for ever and ever upon them that fear him, and his righteousness upon children's children.
The late, most high, most mighty, and most excellent monarch, Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of her other realms and territories, Queen, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, and sovereign of the most noble Order of the Garter.
Thank you.
Let us humbly beseech Almighty God to bless with long life, health and honour, and all worldly happiness, the Most High, Most Mighty and Most Excellent Monarch, our Sovereign Lord, Charles III, now, by the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of his other realms and territories, King, Head of the Commonwealth, Defender of the Faith, and Sovereign of the Most Noble Order of the Garter.
Go forth into the world in peace. Be of good courage. Hold fast that which is good. Render to no one evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted. Support the weak. Help the afflicted. Honour all people. Love and serve the Lord, rejoicing in the power of the Holy Spirit. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be amongst you and remain with you always. Amen.